Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Number three, eating and sleeping correctly and only as necessary. See, black people got a thing about, you know, we got to eat all the time. We go anywhere around some food. We can't hardly have a meeting, see, without having a whole lot of food. They going to feed? You know, you just ate, see? I ain't going over there if they ain't going to feed, see? That's an old tradition that at one time served a purpose. See, we have to turn loose to some traditions. And that's one of them. That's eating every time food is available.
How does intermittent fasting affect your health? By intermittent fasting, we mean people who fast part of the time. Some skip one meal a day. Some don't eat at all for several days per week. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on a study that tracked what happens when people go hungry for 14 hours per day.
There are lots of trendy ways to fast. Some people skip multiple meals. Some fast a few days a week. But Pam Taub, a cardiologist at UC San Diego, says there hasn't been a lot of evidence on which strategies are effective.
There's a lot of bogus claims out there.
People touting extreme versions, such as two-day fasts, which can be dangerous. Taub and her collaborators decided to test a simple and much more moderate approach. They asked people to restrict their eating to a 10-hour window each day.
We didn't ask them to change what they ate. We didn't ask them to change the number of calories that they consumed.
The only instruction was to stick to the 10 hours. So if they ate breakfast at 8 a.m., their last bite of food for the day would need to be eaten by 6 o'clock p.m., making for a pretty early dinner. The participants followed this diet for 3 months, and Taub says she really didn't expect the results she found.
We saw a 3% reduction in their weight and a 4% reduction in the abdominal visceral fat. So it is surprising to get these types of results.
Especially since all the participants really did was to stop eating a few extra hours each day. It turns out that by shutting off eating early, the participants, all of whom were overweight and at risk of diabetes, ate about 8% fewer calories. But this alone, Taub says, is unlikely to explain the weight loss. She thinks there may be other factors at play.
So when you go into a fasting state, typically over 10 hours of fasting, you start to deplete the glucose stores in your body and you start to use fat as your energy source.
In other words, rather than fueling your body on stored sugars, you begin to fuel your body with stored fat. This study was small. Taub and her collaborators have a larger NIH-funded study underway. For now, the new findings offer some preliminary evidence that a 14-hour fast can be beneficial.
When you're constantly giving the body calories, you're constantly making your cells work.
Taub says, think of a few extra hours of fasting as a way of giving your metabolic organs some rest. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
All we need is a voluntary, free-spirited, open-ended program of procreative racial deconstruction.
Everybody just got to keep fucking everybody till they're all the same color? A new memoir by a local author explores parenthood in a changing America. The book titled Once More to the Rodeo tells the story of Boston-based author Calvin Hennick's road trip with his young son to his childhood home in Iowa. Along the way, Hennick tackles tough questions about what it means to be a man and a father in today's world, as well as the challenges of raising a black son in America. Calvin Hennick joins us now to talk about it. Thanks very much for coming into the studio. Good to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bob.
So the story focuses largely on the 10-day road trip you took 2 years ago with your son, Niall, who was then 5 years old. You were headed to an annual rodeo in your hometown of Maxwell, Iowa, which explains the book's title. How did the road trip become the background for the book?
So my son was 5 years old, and he was about to enter kindergarten, which felt sort of bizarrely big and looming over my mind, like the protective bubble that I had placed him in was just starting to begin to pop. And it sort of hit me that, you know, I'm the person most responsible for helping him to become the man that he's going to be when he's an adult. And I sort of realized that I didn't have a lot in the way of answers in terms of what that meant, even for myself. So I thought that this would make a good kind of bucket to put these ideas inside of.
Get into this a little deeper. Why was returning to your hometown so important to you?
It was important to me because I think I had a lot of sort of unresolved family stuff with my own father that I needed to kind of think about and work through, and Iowa seemed like the right place to do that. But also, again, I thought there was this compelling contrast between my son's upbringing, where he would never end up at a rodeo in the suburbs outside of Boston, and just sort of, in a way, it's a homecoming for me and a fish out of water story for him.
You speak openly in the book about the struggles of not only raising a son who's biracial, but also of you, a white man, and what you can teach him about growing up black in America.
Sure. I feel sort of underqualified to be my son's father, in that he's going to face situations or challenges that I never did as a kid. And so there's a story I relate in the book about a 2017 incident at Fenway Park where we were getting in for the baseball game. It was my son's first Red Sox game. And the fan next to me, after a young black woman sang the national anthem, he used the N-word, used a racial slur to describe her singing. And, you know, I was horrified. And at first I was kind of like, well, doesn't he see my biracial son and my black father-in-law here sitting with me? And then I kind of thought, man, well, maybe that's the point. Maybe, you know, it was a way for him to sort of use the N-word against this little boy and get away with it.
So what was it like to watch your son process that event?
He processed it a bunch of different ways really quickly. Like, immediately he sort of very sweetly was worried about the man who had said the slur and was worried about him not being able to come back to the baseball park and worried about, you know, him being sad. But then he kind of got scared. He worried about the man showing up at our house. He worried about going out to other big public events. He'll still sometimes express worry about going to a large public event because what if somebody like that man is there? Mm. And so, you know, then sort of like the saddest point, I had talked to my son on the road trip about racism and segregation. And so after the event at Fenway, my son said, Daddy, I thought that was over, white people and black people not getting along. And it, you know, sort of caught my heart in my throat. And, you know, I had to explain to him that, no, that's not over.
Well, to that point, in 2014, you wrote a piece for Ebony Magazine, and you wrote about your fears for your son's future. Let me read a graph here and get you to comment on it. If he does darken, women will cross the street when they see him coming, the way they sometimes do when they pass my wife's brother on the sidewalk. Convenience store employees will follow him suspiciously around the aisles. Cops may hassle him for things I don't think twice about, like jaywalking. Your son is now 8. This was a 2014 article. Are you worrying about that today, or even more worried about that today?
It definitely, you know, is something that pops up, with, especially when something hits the news where there's been some sort of race-based injustice. I don't think, oh, that could have been me, because in most cases it could not have been me. But I do sometimes think, oh, that could one day be my son, because it could be. And it's not something I obsess about or, you know, belabor over, but it's something that, you know, I want to prepare him to know at some point, you know, how some people are going to perceive him. At the same time, I don't want to give him a complex. I don't want to put a chip on his shoulder. So I think it is this delicate balance, and my wife and I, you know, talk about it a lot.
And looking outward, if I might, what do you want people to take away from your book?
The book doesn't lend itself up to easy answers. You know, it's not, here's the secret of parenting, or, you know, to be a good father, do X, Y, Z. But I kind of would like, if people read it, and to just build in those moments where you do take a step back, and, you know, parenthood can easily become about diapers and school drop-offs and soccer practice and homework and emails to school. But those are just the details. Those aren't really the meat of what we're trying to do here. So I'd love it if people read the book and sort of took a pause and found some time with their own kids to sort of ask the big questions about, hey, what am I trying to do here?
Calvin Hennick, author of the new book, Once More to the Rodeo. Thanks a lot for joining us. It was great to meet you. And good luck over the next 10 years till your son gets to be 18.
Thanks so much, Bob.
The book, Once More to the Rodeo.
You keep it going, man. You keep those books rolling. You pick up all those books that you're going to read and not remember, and you roll, man. You get that associate's degree, okay? Then you get your bachelor's. Then you get your master's. Then you get your master's master's. Then you get your doctorate. You go, man. And then when everybody says quit, you show them those degrees, man. When everyone says, hey, you're not working, you're not making any money, you say, you look at my degrees and you look at my life. Yeah, I'm 52. So what? Hate all you want, but I'm smart. I'm so smart, and I'm in school. These guys out here making money all these ways, and I'm spending mine to be smart.
Back before the housing market crashed more than a decade ago, a lending watchdog named Mike Calhoun sounded the alarm early on about reckless subprime loans.
We projected over 2 million subprime mortgage foreclosures, and the response was we were ridiculed by the industry.
As we know now, Calhoun was right. The wave of foreclosures was even bigger than he predicted, and it drove the economy into the Great Recession. These days, Calhoun is warning about student loans, and he sees a lot of parallels. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Mike Calhoun is a man on a mission. He's flying around the country, warning state lawmakers and prosecutors, sharing his worries at conferences and with members of Congress. He's saying, just like with the housing crisis, student loans are given out without considering whether the borrower will be able to pay the money back.
Once again, it's the mismatch between the debt and the borrower's income, their ability to repay.
Calhoun's the president of the nonprofit Center for Responsible Lending, and he says the amount of money that people owe on student loans is growing very fast.
Absolutely explosive growth in the amount of student debt. In about a dozen years, it's gone from $300 billion to now $1.6 trillion.
This time around, it's the government making the vast majority of the loans. That's effectively turned the Education Department into the largest consumer lending bank in the country. And Calhoun says more and more people can't pay.
Already in the student loan world, we are seeing default levels that approach what there was in the subprime mortgage world.
Wearing a no-nonsense blue blazer with his gray mustache and spectacles, Calhoun could pass for a banker himself. But for decades, he has actually been keeping watch over the banks. In his office in Washington, Calhoun pulls up a slide on his computer monitor and shows me another parallel. In the subprime mortgage mess, minority groups were hit the hardest. And now,
as we sit here and talk today, over a fifth of Black college graduates are in default on their student loans because of the amount of debt they took on and the fact that they typically still earn less in the job market.
These guys out here making money all these ways, and I'm spending mine to be smart.
Still, some people say talk of a student loan crisis is overblown. Mike McPherson is an economist and former college president who studies higher ed financing.
I think of a crisis as being a situation which is getting rapidly worse.
And he says actually that's not what's happening with student loans. He says the total amount borrowed in new loans each year has been declining since the peak in 2010. And he says most people with a college or advanced degree, of course, are much better off financially even if they have student loans. Also,
a lot of people borrow a small amount of money. So a third of all the people owe less than $10,000.
Calhoun acknowledges that this time around, this is a different kind of lending debacle. It's not going to implode the banking system. But he says there are so many people now with student loans, and many owe a lot more money and are running into serious problems.
The student loan crisis will affect tens of millions of families.
Calhoun says their credit scores are getting messed up, or they're missing out on home ownership because they can't qualify for a mortgage. And this albatross of debt hanging around the necks of so many Americans is now a central issue in the presidential election. So where is all this headed?
Hopefully it ends in a couple ways, that for some borrowers, you will need to write down some part of what they owe. They simply don't have the capacity to repay that based upon their earning capacity.
And Calhoun says the government needs to fix existing programs that could help millions of people. One in particular has promised to forgive large amounts of student loan debt for public service workers like police and teachers, but it's been badly mismanaged. Also, many people don't get enrolled in repayment plans that could make their loans affordable. Calhoun says until such problems get fixed, it may not wreck the economy, but it will be a drag on it. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
There are practical tips from NPR's Life Kit on managing student loan debt at npr.org/lifekit.
Remember, no one is going to treat you special just because you are black.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is playing defense. Going into his freshman year at the University of Washington back in 2001, Lul Mengesha felt like he was prepared. For high school, Lul went to Rainier Beach in South Seattle. He was an honors student, he ran cross country, and he was part of a student leadership group.
I was really involved and ambitious.
Lul's family's from Ethiopia, and at Rainier Beach, there were a lot of students who looked like him. But his confidence took a hit after taking UW's math placement test.
Everybody has to take that placement test going into UW, and it places you into, you know, pre-calculus or calculus or algebra, whatever. Then I actually placed into a no-credit math class, Math 98. That was like the first blow in college, like realizing that now, even though everybody kind of knew I was smart in my high school, that just didn't matter anymore.
Lul didn't settle for taking remedial math. He found free tutoring, took the test again, and got into a higher-level math course. But the realization that succeeding in high school still didn't prepare him for UW dovetailed with another new reality. He was often one of the only black students in his classes. That came with obstacles, large and small, to his success. Lul says he had to armor himself against those setbacks. Later, he'd document his solutions and workarounds in his book, The Only Black Student, published in 2009. The people Lul wants to reach are students like 19-year-old Royce Kelly.
I am a 6'3", 180-pound, light-skinned man with long hair. I'm black and white. This is what I am, and I'm proud of what I am.
Royce graduated from Rainier Beach last June. He's attending community college in Seattle, and he hopes to transfer to Louisiana State University. Royce and Lul sat down to talk about what it's like to navigate mostly white institutions.
The reason I wrote The Only Black Student was because I was an upperclassman, and I was meeting students like you. It felt like I was meeting smart people who were dropping out. It was always about something outside of the classroom, like they were short on rent or short on their dorm, you know, dorm room payment, and they didn't know that they could just ask like a counselor if they knew of any scholarships or emergency financial aid. It just always seemed like there was this game that was being played that people just didn't understand how to navigate, and that's what I felt like. I was always much better at that than I was in the actual classroom. So let's move 2 years into the future, and you just finished up at South Seattle, which is a very diverse space, smaller classes. You've gotten to know people. There's people who kind of look like you. There's people who have similar backgrounds. And then you're going to LSU, which is more homogenous. What concerns do you have or might have about that transition?
That I'll have to, like, code switch. So I'm half white. So I have white family. And I'm very familiar with how they speak to people and how they interact with other people. So when I'm talking to certain people, I'll take the bass out of my voice. If I'm talking to somebody that I feel like can affect what I'm doing, I'm usually more like submissive and want to avoid conflict with that person. I guess I kind of just like, I change up how I talk and then how I act in certain ways. Because, I mean, I'm very animated and I move around a lot like I'm doing now. Nobody can see me besides you guys, but I'm moving right. My hands. And it's just, yeah, I'm a very animated person. When I'm talking to certain people, I sort of just stop what I'm doing.
Be more reserved.
And be more reserved, yeah. And I'm just, that's not who I actually am.
I don't code switch anymore. I'm like who I am as much as I can be.
When did you stop code switching so much?
I think, you know, luckily I do live in Oakland, California now, and I feel like it's just a lot easier to be more of yourself there because we have so many examples of people that are successful who speak in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the Northwest is probably a little more conservative around that type of identity. Like if I lived back in Seattle and I worked corporate or government or you know, tech here, I feel like I probably would have to make some of those sacrifices. And I wouldn't want to do that at this stage because I love who I am and I want to be as true to that as possible. With my book, The Only Black Student, so much is kind of like arming yourself and how you navigate. And it sounds like you're already thoughtful about what are certain ways that you're perceived and how you have to arm yourself. When you are in college and you know you have long hair and it's you know people are going to ask to touch your hair a lot, so and I know you've already dealt with that, but you're going to be in spaces where people don't look like you who are asking to touch your hair, and it's going to, you know, it's a judgment call on your end, you know. Yeah. But I was very uncomfortable with it, and sometimes I'd be playful and other times I'd be like, no, you know, it's because I used to have long hair. Yeah, so that, but it's going to happen. People, again, are going to be in your space and they're going to try to take away your agency of your own space, your own body over and over again. So you got to look out for yourself. Being profiled happened multiple times on campus. I had a friend that, I mean, this one, it was, we were so oblivious to how it could be perceived, but he locked his keys in his car, and I went upstairs to my dorm to get him a coat hanger, and he's driving a hoopty. And a hoopty is a car that is low cost, typically has like rims on it, and is like either a Cadillac or let's say a 1999 music video type of car. But anyways, right? So he's the only person on campus that would have this car. Multiple people called the cops on us. So I think three cop cars pull up on us and we're still not getting what's happening, you know. We're like trying to get into his car and we were the threat, you know. So eventually they realize that we're trying to get into his car and one of the officers helps us get in. But I was like, oh, you know, this is another example of me understanding that the students on campus didn't really see me as like a fellow student.
I would feel like it's just like, all right, man. But at the end of that, it's still my car. So I'm just, you know, I'd still be pretty calm about it, though.
We don't get to be emotionally expressive. So knowing that even the advocacy of against a accusation, we have to be in control, which is, it's really wild that we have to be in control when dealing with an authoritative figure like a police officer, which is not, I mean, we're civilians. Mm. You know, it's not our job.
Yeah.
That's like, I think, one part of understanding how to navigate this country. The second part is then speaking up for yourself in a way that does not get you harmed. Mm-hmm. So you already know the neutralizing the situation. You're like, oh, you know what? The stakes are not that big here. This is not a big deal. So in the grand scheme of things, which really is, that shows just how self-aware you are. And the other part is saying to yourself, like, you're going to fight for every single one of these little attacks on you. Because that's what I do now. It doesn't matter how small it is, because you need to always be practicing advocacy. You don't need to always practice speaking up for yourself. It's, you know, always practice speaking up for other people. And every time you do that, you feel just a bit better. One way that I would get professors to see me in the classroom, I would often just ask a professor if they could repeat themselves, if they said something like a lower tone that nobody else could hear, because I just wanted to hear my voice in a class of 400 people. Hearing your voice in these classes is some form of feeling like you've been acknowledged and accepted. What do you want to do, Royce?
I want to major in kinesiology.
Okay.
And since I was an athlete, my trainer, mm-hmm. like the dude that took care of us when we got hurt, I always thought that job was pretty cool. Right. Because it's like, I like helping people, so.
The people that we look for, like the mentors that I talked about, we can often find them in a lot of different places. For me, at the University of Washington, there was a black chemistry professor, and just even seeing him on campus really made me understand that it was possible to be in this realm and be in mm-hmm. this world. When you see somebody who looks like you, who is successful in a space that you're curious about, it makes it seem much more tangible and real.
That story was produced by Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. Lul Mangesha is an author, a filmmaker, and the founder of a startup in Oakland, California. Royce Kelly is a recent graduate of the International Baccalaureate Program at Seattle's Rainier Beach High School.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Maplewood's funky business district and central location are attracting young families. That means rising home prices and more students in the Maplewood-Richmond Heights School District. As a result, the school has become whiter and wealthier as Maplewood experiences gentrification. St. Louis Public Radio's Ryan Delaney reports on how families and school administrators are grappling with the growing pains.
Lainey Schenkelberg didn't buy this house in Maplewood with the intention of raising a family in it. With four kids ranging from a few months to 9 years old, plus a cat, a day off from school can mean a noisy living room.
Oh, we're going to dump them all out. That's great. We love it when you do that.
When it was time for their oldest, yeah. Xavier, to start school more than 5 years ago, Lainey and her husband Eric first considered private options. But then a friend convinced them to check out Maplewood Richmond Heights Early Childhood Center.
And it was surreal. They had an organic farm. They had chickens. They had these little houses and the playground. The campus was phenomenal.
Enrolling Xavier was easy. Getting their third child into pre-K required standing in line early in the morning. Despite their crowded living room here and the full preschool nearby, the Schenkelbergs love the community and their neighborhood full of other young families.
We actually considered moving a few years ago because we're running out of space with all of these children, and we decided we like Maplewood so much that we're just going to put an addition on this house and stay where we are.
Families all over Maplewood are making those same decisions. They're buying houses, putting on additions, and sending their kids to the public school district. Enrollment in MRH has been rising for 14 years after more than a decade of smaller and smaller classes. It follows a steady improvement in the district's academics since the early 2000s. Superintendent Karen Hall didn't anticipate such large class size increases in her small district when she began 8 years ago.
It's a unique position to be in where you're growing. And it's like, well, you have to be concerned. Yeah, but, you know, it's gentrification on one side of the coin. And on the other side of the coin is urban renewal, you know, depending upon who you talk to and what they think about.
MRH's student body has been a mix of white and minority students for decades. But more and more new students filling desks are white, and even more so, they're wealthier. The number of kids who qualify for free or reduced lunch, a metric of poverty in schools, has stayed mostly steady for two decades, but they're now a smaller percentage of MRH students. Home prices in Maplewood have risen to be $100,000 more than they were a decade ago, an increase outpacing the rest of the region.
It's hard because I am grateful that people are moving here. I will never, ever say that I'm unhappy about that, ever.
With the rising home values and more businesses comes more funding for education, which Hall says has allowed her to hire great teachers and expand extracurriculars. Hall and school board members know that same revitalization that's adding more funding for schools is also straining some longtime residents. Linda Robinson graduated from MRH High School in 1987. Her daughter attended magnet and private schools in the city before eventually graduating from MRH. Now Robinson's granddaughter is a sixth grader in the district. The three of them share a two-bedroom apartment behind the Schlafly Brewery with boxes stacked in corners of the living room.
I'm like, that's fine. Because at the end of the day, my granddaughter's going to Maplewood School District, and that's what matters.
Her daughter is hoping to move out next year, but Robinson says it'll be a challenge to find an affordable place.
Even though we have nice apartments in Maple and Richmond Heights, a two-bedroom could start off at $1,200 a month. So, okay, you know, do I take a chance and try to afford this every month so my child could be in the school district, or what do I do?
Superintendent Hall and the school board are advocating for affordable housing policies with city leaders in Maplewood and Richmond Heights. Gentrification is on the minds of young parents in the district as well. Like many of the families moving to Maplewood, progressive policies and the diversity of the district was another big draw for the Schenkelbergs.
I think that we are mindful that, you know, we could be part of the problem, or we could use that, you know, position that we have in order to advocate for equity and inclusion and make sure that we are doing everything that we can to help maintain equity throughout the district.
A bond measure is likely to be on the ballot this spring. It'll ask residents to approve funding to expand the middle and high school campus to make room for its growing class sizes. I'm Ryan Delaney, St. Louis Public Radio. To be
An unwanted spotlight is on schools in West Suburban Naperville after a student allegedly made a racist Craigslist ad last month. Some families and faculty members say the incident is just a public example of behavior that has been common for years. District officials say they've been working to change this, and part of that is rebuilding trust. WBEZ's Susie Ahn has our story.
Last year, Dr. Rakita Leakes was hired as Naperville School District 203's Executive Director of Diversity and Inclusion. Recently, she's been having to put out fires after the racist incident from Naperville Central High School went public.
That incident was just a reminder about how critical this work is.
A student was accused of posting an ad on Craigslist with a picture of a black student titled Slave for Sale. Many families of color say it's just one example of what's been going on in the district for years. They've asked administrators to hire someone like Leakes, and now they hope she'll use this moment to bring about meaningful change.
That's the angle in which I'm leveraging that particular incident, is to really think about, like, what can we do with students to make sure that they're culturally aware and culturally sensitive and that they're respecting each other.
It's a tall task, especially when some families doubt the district that has a black student population of 5% will ever change. Marla Baker moved with her children to Naperville from southern Illinois. She picked the community because she says on paper it looked like a great place to live and raise kids. But she remembers 3 years ago when she got a call from school that her son got in a fight with another middle school boy. She says her son got an in-school suspension while the other student was able to return to class. Baker says the school told her the other boy received a lesser punishment because he was just playing around.
So you call his behavior boys being boys, but you said what my son did was more aggressive. So you put him in school suspension. And that was kind of like the first time where there was a red flag to me that there might be some bias.
Then in eighth grade, her son was racially bullied over social media while at school during school hours.
There was a part of it where it was like, yo, you just need to kill yourself. And then they sent him pictures of a noose. They sent him pictures of the KKK.
Baker says they used a racial slur multiple times on the thread. She discovered the bullying and asked her son why he didn't tell anyone.
He's like, the last time I told somebody, I got in trouble and I was called aggressive. So I just felt like if I didn't say anything, it would go away.
Baker reported what happened to district officials. She says she tried to report it as a hate crime with the police, but was referred back to the school. Baker wanted to move her son to a different school, but she says the district discouraged it at first, saying it would be best if her son learned how to handle these kinds of problems. The district has 22 schools and serves more than 16,000 students. Baker says her son started questioning his worth, and now that he's in high school, she says he's withdrawn. And it made her question her parenting.
There are some days that I cry because I feel helpless and I feel powerless and I feel like I can't do anything.
Black parents and students aren't the only ones feeling discouraged by the administration. Brandy McClinton, who is Black, worked at a Naperville elementary school in 2017. She heard staff make comments that implied working with students of color was like working with animals. She remembers discussing with a colleague how to respond to a young girl who said she calls Black people chocolate ice cream. The colleague didn't think there was anything wrong with that, and in fact, she said she called Black people Tootsie Rolls.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay drama. Pondy replay.
The delectable Negro. Human consumption and homoeroticism in U.S. slave culture.
Just give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
She remembers discussing with a colleague how to respond to a young girl who said she calls Black people chocolate ice cream. The colleague didn't think there was anything wrong with that. And in fact, she said she called Black people Tootsie Rolls.
We already had a discussion about her calling Black people Tootsie Rolls that it would have changed, because I believe that if people are saying something out of ignorance and they don't know it's offensive, it's one thing. But once you inform somebody that that's an offensive statement and they continue it and they're an adult, that's not acceptable.
McClinton says she had to take on tasks that weren't part of her job description, like collecting forms and handling discipline for Black students. She was also asked to make calls to Black parents. Many times she had no previous connection with these families.
But with the administration, it was more the parents lacking the skills to communicate with them is how they portrayed it.
McClinton says her attempts to report these things were dismissed, and she said she faced retaliation for raising them. After one semester, she left.
I went to counseling after that because it was emotionally damaging. And I wasn't going to ruin my career over them, and I wasn't going to continue to get depressed over them.
The district would not respond to questions about Baker and McClinton's specific incidents for privacy reasons. But Dr. Leake says she recognizes the district has done things in the past that validate their concerns.
Maybe the perception is that's out there is that it had not been a priority in the past, but I want to make it clear to them that it is a priority right now.
More than 90% of teachers in Naperville are white. Dr. Leake says in the past, it's likely staff did not recognize they had blind spots when it came to race. If they've never experienced racism or implicit bias, it may be easy to dismiss something as an isolated incident. Leake says that's why it's important for the community to recognize the pain and burden people of color have endured.
We can heal together, and we can find some resolution in how to move forward and to address those situations appropriately.
Leakes has laid out a plan for immediate priorities that includes a curriculum audit and deep equity trainings for staff. She's also looking at how to change hiring practices to increase diversity. Parents like Carrie King are hopeful. She says her daughters have dealt with racial bias at school, though not as severe as what Baker's son experienced. She says under Leakes, things were moving in the right direction, but very slowly. She says the district has been a powder keg, and what happened at Naperville Central High School sparked the explosion. She hopes that that public backlash will accelerate change.
We have been asking for that level of accountability for some time. Now they're in a position where they're going to have to show some level of accountability because all eyes are watching.
Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
This the city of Chicago. Chicago.
December in Chicago. It was an early morning in December, 1969, when a joint FBI Chicago police crew raided an apartment building, ostensibly for weapons charges. In fact, they came to kill Fred Hampton, chairman of the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party, and a man chosen by the party's central committee to become the new chief of staff of the national organization. Hampton, barely 21, would be shot to death in his bed, in his sleep. Also killed, Mark Clark, a captain from Peoria, Illinois, who was security for the apartment. The killing of Fred made him a martyr for Blacks in Chicago and for Panthers across the nation. This year marks 50 years since his assassination. How many cops were sent to death row in Illinois for this most premeditated of murders in Chicago? I think you know the answer. Zero. Fred's wife worked for Black freedom movements for years. His son, sleeping in her belly while his father was assassinated by the state, became an outspoken freedom fighter for the black nation. And Fred Hampton, though gone, is not forgotten. He remains a martyred symbol of resistance. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
What they give you, blood?
3 months, man.
What you doing in here anyway? You ought to be home with your mama. How old are you, boy?
13.
13? Damn. The bastards must be running out of niggas to arrest.
It was almost a year ago when President Trump signed into law a bipartisan federal criminal justice reform bill that reduced mandatory sentences. Many states followed suit, with a notable exception, the state of Maryland. In this story, produced in collaboration with the University of Maryland's Howard Center for Investigative Journalism, national correspondent John Yang reports on the uncertain fate of prisoners who are still serving life sentences for crimes they committed as minors.
In the 1990s, fear and anger over violent crime led to a sharp increase in incarceration. That included sentencing large numbers of juveniles to life in adult prisons without parole. In 2012, the Supreme Court declared that cruel and unusual punishment. But in Maryland, so-called juvenile lifers now in their 50s and 60s still wait for parole. Earl Young had been sentenced to life at age 17.
The system is broke. The system needs fixing. And one individual, Mr. Paris Glendenny, was the head of this situation.
Paris Glendenny was Maryland's liberal Democratic governor. During his first campaign in 1994, he sought to counter attacks that he was soft on crime.
We must stop the slaughter that is going on in our communities. I support putting violent offenders in prison and giving what I call truth in sentencing. If you're sentenced to life in prison, it ought to mean life in prison, and not 11 years the way it does today.
By 1994, Earl Young had served 9 years for first-degree murder in a robbery gone wrong.
Tell me what it was like as a 17-year-old to go into a maximum security prison.
Hard. I went into the Maryland Penitentiary with some of society's, supposedly some of society's worst of the worst.
Were you scared?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
His hope, the possibility of parole.
I felt optimistic because I applied myself. I kept steady employment. I stayed out of trouble to the best of my ability. My days were complete with, from the beginning to the end, with all constructive things.
But after Glendenning announced in 1995 he would no longer sign paroles, Young would remain in prison another 24 years. More than 300 juvenile lifers sit in Maryland prisons, among them 55-year-old Calvin McNeil, convicted at 17 of first-degree murder in a dice game turned violent. We spoke to him by phone.
I was sentenced to life with parole. That's been 38 years. 3 months and 10 days ago. Every time I go up, they always say, keep doing what you're doing and such, but we can't do anything right now because of what the governor said, and I've been stuck ever since.
Now Glendenning sees things differently.
I made a mistake. It was a very bad mistake in the sense that it impacted people, impacted subsequent administrations. But it was a mistake, and I think it's important to acknowledge.
Because of the governor's extraordinary power, that mistake had an outsized impact.
Maryland is fairly unique among states in giving the authority to parole someone serving a life sentence exclusively to the governor. In other states, it would be a parole board.
ACLU attorney Sonia Kumar is suing the state to restore a full parole system and allow these lifers a chance at release.
Maryland system has been set up so that opportunities for release are almost like winning the lottery. It's unpredictable. It's rare. There are many more people who are arguably deserving of it that can ever get it.
The figures in the ACLU suit are striking. Before Glenn Denning, four governors issued 181 parole orders over 25 years. In the next 23 years, starting with Glenn Denning, just two paroles were issued, both by current Governor Larry Hogan, both adult lifers.
You are serving a sentence that is life with parole on paper, but in practice, parole is really unattainable.
From his Baltimore office, Walter Lomax has organized lifers and their families as part of the ACLU lawsuit.
We became more politically astute, right? Individuals understood that this was a political issue because the governor made that decision based on politics.
Lomax had been in prison 38 years before it was established he had been wrongfully convicted. When Glenn Denning said he would no longer sign paroles, Lomax's parole recommendation was sitting on the governor's desk.
I was one of those people, so it was pretty demoralizing. Yeah.
He understands the perspective of victims' families.
My younger brother was murdered, and one of my grandsons was murdered in this city. And so I personally know the pain and anguish that family member feel for that loss. Some of these men who've committed horrible crimes, and I look at them at this later point in their lives, and I see someone that's totally remorseful, that's totally different from the person that they were when they committed the crime.
I'm 55 years old. I have to be a person that's crazy and out of his mind that has spent 30-something years in prison to go back out into society and do something crazy, come back to prison?
Earl Young's sentence was commuted this year by Governor Hogan. He now works as a mentor in the Baltimore school system, trying to discourage teams from repeating his mistakes.
How had you changed in those 34 years?
Impulsive behavior? Gone. Immature thinking? Gone. Putting others before myself? Absolutely.
Glenn Denning now says the governor should be taken out of the process.
Of all the powers you want, you know, to be involved in that kind of decision is not one of them. The issues are too emotional and too political to put it on the desk of someone who's going to turn around in a few months, a year, and run for election. And almost ask for political decisions on something that should not be political.
Yes, individuals have committed some serious crimes. But, and I say but, for those who are deserving of a second opportunity, what's the process? It has to be better than what we have.
Times may be changing. In recent weeks, Hogan has paroled the first three juvenile lifers in 24 years. Young cherishes Hogan's letter telling him he would be a free man.
The best thing that I read during the course of my incarceration was the executive order with my name on it. It says, "Dear Mr. Young, I have accepted the recommendation of Maryland Parole Commission and ordered that your life sentence be conditionally commuted to life sentence with all but 49 years suspended. During most of your incarceration, you have served your sentence in exemplary fashion. You have chosen to be positive and a productive person. Please make the most of this second chance."
A second chance hundreds of juvenile lifers may never get. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang in Baltimore.
That we are not going to play with sex so that the joke is on the offspring. See, sex may be highly enjoyable, but it's not to be demeaned and degraded so we end up producing throwaway children.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Last year, the number of children in foster care decreased for the first time since 2011. That's according to data from the Department of Health and Human Services. It's a relatively small drop from 440,000 in 2017 to a little over 437,000 in 2018. And today on The Takeaway, we're zooming in on this small decline. And one place to look is New Orleans. A couple of weeks ago, The Washington Post profiled juvenile court Justice Ernestine S. Gray. Under Justice Gray's purview, the number of children in foster care dropped by 89% between 2011 and 2017. And The Takeaway spoke with Judge Gray about it.
Obviously, we have to protect the children, but in protecting them, we also should honor the family connections. And so we have to work really hard at the beginning of a case to try to make sure that when we are separating children from their families, it's absolutely necessary for their safety and their protection.
Most judges and social service workers would agree that you only remove a child from their family when absolutely necessary. But that doesn't mean that they all agree on what qualifies as absolutely necessary. And that's why the number of children in foster care is so different in Judge Gray's jurisdiction than in the rest of Louisiana.
Many of the problems we see in child welfare are related to poverty. And so a large percentage of the minority community is poor. I think it's related to that. So a lot of the reason is related to poverty and lack of resources in the various communities that people can connect to help them when they are in crisis. So part of the problem we have is people have to come to the attention of the child welfare system before they can get help. They may reach out for help many times and are unable to get it. And then something really bad happens and then child welfare is called.
Racial stereotypes can sometimes factor into the determination of who gets the attention of child welfare services and who gets removed from their homes. In 2017, according to the nonprofit Child Trends, 23% of foster care children in the United States were Black, despite making up only 14% of the population. In New York City, child welfare workers remove children from their homes for seemingly minor issues, in a way that advocates say punishes Black and Hispanic mothers. But while social workers and child welfare officers can remove a child from a home if they determine abuse or neglect, it's the judge who has the final say over the case.
I think clearly there are times when my assessment of the situation is different from theirs. And so as a judge, I'm allowed to have that. So they present their case to me. I look at the facts and the evidence that they're presenting and decide whether or not I believe it's appropriate to allow them to take custody of their children. And there are times when I disagree with their assessment, yes. And when I disagree with their assessment, I don't put the children in foster care. I say we have to do something different. But so I'm not one to say just because the department calls with a request, I have to give them what they're asking for. That's not my job. My job is not to rubber stamp. My job is really to make an assessment of the situation and decide, based on the law, based on the facts that they give me, whether or not I think, ultimately it's the judge's decision, whether or not I think, under the circumstances, it is appropriate to remove the children.
But because Judge Gray has drastically lowered the rates of children in foster care in New Orleans, doesn't mean she thinks that foster care should be eliminated altogether.
Sometimes all of our efforts, we make a lot of efforts and they're not successful. And in those cases, you know, I make the hard decision that the best interest of the children require that the parents' rights be terminated, that they be freed for adoption. Ultimately, hopefully, they are adopted.
I want to bring in two different perspectives on the issue. We'll start with Dr. David Sanders. He's the Executive Vice President of Systems Improvement at Casey Family Programs and used to run the L.A. County Department of Child and Family Services. And he told me that while foster care is supposed to be a short-term intervention, that's not always the way it works in practice.
25% of children in foster care have been there for 2 years or longer without a permanent family. That's a concern. That would suggest that many children are staying in foster care for much longer than they need to and much longer than the legal structure allows for.
But it's not always clear what's best for the child when judges and social workers disagree.
One of the things we did look at in a recent Maryland study was what happens when the child welfare worker recommends that the child not go home and the judge sends the child home from foster care anyway.
That's Richard Barth, and he's the dean of the University of Maryland School of Social Work.
when the judge recommended that the child go home, even when the child welfare worker said that they shouldn't, the likelihood that that child would come back into foster care following a new event of child abuse and neglect was twice as high. So it's really important that judges and child welfare workers understand each other and respect each other's views about what the real risks are. I think this is really the first study that's looked at this and shown that the likelihood of a poor decision that results in a child being reabused is about twice as high when the judge overrules the child welfare worker.
While the goal of the Casey Family Programs is to reduce the use of foster care, Barth argues that we should be thinking about reforming foster care because it can help children in need. And he has a different perspective on the high number of children of color currently in foster care.
Well, it certainly is true that there are a disproportionate to the population number of African-American children in particular in foster care. But the bigger question, I think, is the use of foster care disproportionate to the needs of those children? And what we see is that the outcomes for African-American children who remain at home are also disproportionately adverse. They have more mortality. They have more involvement with the criminal justice system. So one of the goals that we all need to have is to make sure that when we do use foster care, because sometimes we need to, that it's really high-quality foster care. We have many opportunities to improve foster care, and those improvements in foster care would disproportionately benefit African-American children, in my view.
But how much money and political will is there to actually improve foster care, especially when it's disproportionately used in communities of color and poor communities? That's what's being addressed in the Family First Prevention Services Act, which Congress passed last year. It provides funds and reforms to help keep children with their families, and the goal is to avoid having these children taken away by foster care agencies in the first place, which can be traumatizing for the child and the parent. Here's David Sanders again from Casey Family Programs. In 2016, he worked on a report for the Congressional Commission to eliminate child abuse and neglect fatalities, and he was a proponent of the new law.
The way the Child Protection Agency is structured today is that agencies wait for children to be abused or neglected before intervening, in spite of the fact that we have more and more evidence of who's at risk for later abuse or neglect. I think that the focus that we need to stay clear on is that we are better off assuring that children aren't abused or neglected in the first place and using the tools that we have to make that happen versus waiting for children to be abused or neglected or even killed.
That was Dr. David Sanders, the Executive Vice President of Systems Improvement at Casey Family Programs, and Richard Barth, the Dean of the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Foster care is a very fraught issue, and we asked you for your experiences with the foster care system. And here's what you had to say.
Hi, this is Jennifer, and I'm calling from Texas. I have been a foster parent, and the biggest challenges that I saw were kids constantly returning to places where they were unsafe, only to have to re-enter the system again and again.
Hi, my name's Kevin. I'm calling from Florida, and I was a foster parent for 3 years. The caseworkers are overworked, underpaid, and another thing is the whole system is skewed to where the bio parents, they bend over backwards for the bio parents, and the foster parents have very low standing in the system, I guess.
My name is Susan. I used to be a social worker for the Department of Health and Human Services Child Abuse Division. The biggest issues I witnessed is a huge shortage of good foster care homes. It was extremely hard to place siblings in the same foster home. It's also extremely difficult to place older children and teens and children with special needs and behavior problems.
Hi, my name is Rachel. I'm from Mount Olive, New Jersey. My grandmother has done foster care for as long as I can remember, ever since I was like 5. The foster care system is amazing. I don't really have anything negative to say about it. However, the older generation of foster kids are a little bit more intense. All of the children aged 12 and up were just a lot of trouble. They made things really hard on my grandmother and the family, which is understandable. They're older. They, you know, they've seen more. They have more trauma. It just makes it really hard for older kids to get taken in from other foster families.
The stars at night!
a big and bright.
He can come out of Texas.
On to a developing story in Galveston County, a political controversy that has the attention of the top Republicans in the state. The chairman of the Galveston County Republican Party under fire for a racist text message. Channel 2's Robert Arnold joining us live at the Galveston County Annex in League City with a story making waves all the way to Austin. Robert?
Yeah, we've learned this text message was actually sent in March, but its contents did not start getting circulated and come to light until last month. A source in the county did send us a screen grab of that text exchange, and it does appear to be Dr. Yolanda Waters discussing another member of the party. No answer at a home listed for Galveston County Republican Party Chair Yolanda Waters. Two messages left on separate phone numbers also have not been returned. The issue stems from what our source says was this text exchange between Waters and another person. The two are discussing another member of the party asking for money to travel. Waters writing that their personal money tree dried up and then appears to refer to the person using what looks like an abbreviated version of the N-word. The state Republican Party immediately condemned the language and told KPRC, "We have asked Ms. Waters to resign and look forward to the new positive leadership Galveston County deserves." Governor Greg Abbott's office also asked Waters to step down from an appointed board that deals with prison inmates who have medical or mental health issues. A spokesperson for the governor told us her comments are completely abhorrent and have no place in the Republican Party or in the public discourse. About 30 minutes ago, we received a call from a member of the State Republican Executive Committee for Senate District 11. That would be J.T. Edwards. Mr. Edwards told us he has seen that text exchange and he believes he is the one that Waters is talking about. He also asked us to use the following statement, which I will now read. "I am dismayed and disheartened that someone I considered a dear friend would abandon our collective standards for civil discourse and respectful, dignified communication. What's more, it is sad to see someone Galveston County entrusted to lead our party fall to irretrievable deaths." Now, as we mentioned, Waters has not responded to our messages yet, but she did send a statement to the Galveston County Daily News in which she wrote that that word was a typo. Reporting live from League City, Robert Arnold, KPRC.
Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That is the interaction with black people and white people every day, wherever they happen to be. It's going to be one of those categories, a combination of all three. Before the day is over. But it doesn't get any better than tacky. I call it the three T's. Tacky, trashy, terrorist.
The FBI now says it is investigating the shooting Friday at the Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida, as an act of terrorism. It's been confirmed that the gunman was a 21-year-old lieutenant in the Royal Saudi Air Force who opened fire in a classroom building on the base, killing three people and wounding eight others. The FBI says a number of other Saudis also on the base that day are cooperating with the investigation. NPR's Greg Allen has the latest from Pensacola.
The gunman, identified as Mohammed Saeed al-Shamrani, was at the Naval Air Station for flight training. He was part of a group of trainees from Saudi Arabia, one of more than 100 nations whose military received training at U.S. facilities. For the first time, the FBI agent in charge of the Pensacola investigation, Rachel Rojas, said it may be terrorism.
"We are, as we do in most active shooter investigations, work with the presumption that this was an act of terrorism."
Other officials have been less guarded. Today, the president's national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, said on CBS that reports he's seen suggest the gunman may have been radicalized.
"It looks like terrorism. We'll have to see what the FBI investigation shows, what his motivations were. The Saudis have promised full cooperation with the investigation. We're going to take them at their word."
The FBI says a number of other Saudis are training at the Naval Air Station, including some who have close ties to the gunman. None have been detained. Rojas says under orders of their Saudi commander, they've been restricted to a portion of the base. And she says they're all cooperating with the investigation.
"Our main goal right now is to confirm whether he acted alone or was he a part of a larger network. We currently assess there was one gunman who perpetrated this attack, and no arrests have been made in this case.
This was the FBI's most extensive briefing since taking over the investigation Friday. Rojas shared few details, saying she was concerned about misinformation, but declined to go into specifics. Officials say they want to get the facts out to dispel rumors. Rojas addressed one rumor that's kept local law enforcement busy, worries that there could be another attack in Pensacola.
As we have stated multiple times, our investigation has not led us to any information that indicates any credible threat to our community.
Rojas also said reports that authorities were still trying to locate Saudis who were training at the base were wrong.
I can report that the FBI is working side by side with the U.S. Navy, and they have confirmed to us that they have 100% accountability on all international students from NAS Pensacola.
Rojas says the gun used in the shooting, a 9mm Glock, was purchased legally in Florida by the gunman, but wouldn't give details. She also refused to discuss whether a Twitter account is connected with the shooter. A post on the account just before the shooting accused America with crimes against Muslims. Late yesterday, the Navy released the names of the three sailors killed in the shooting. They're 23-year-old Joshua Caleb Watson from Alabama, a recent graduate of the Naval Academy, Mohammed Haytham from Florida, a 19-year-old in flight crew training, and 23-year-old Cameron Scott Walters from Georgia, an airman apprentice. Greg Allen, NPR News, Pensacola.
Yo, 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 once upon a time up in Jersey, yo.
We will begin, however, with a few minutes on the phone today with Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop, who has an update on the horrific mass shooting yesterday that has left six people, I think that's still an accurate count, dead, and is looking more like an anti-Semitic hate crime, at least in part, and an anti-police crime, too. Mayor Fulop, thank you so much for a few minutes for our listeners on this awful, awful day in Jersey City. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the support.
And, Mr. Mayor, first to the human toll, what's the latest on the dead and injured in this incident, numbers and locations and IDs, if it's time for that yet?
Let me say that your numbers are accurate, and on the injured, there were several potentially that actually went to a hospital across the river, so that number's unclear, but we're still working through all that stuff. With regards to the names of the victims and the actors, we're going to defer to the Attorney General on that. The way New Jersey state law works is that they assume the investigation, and that's appropriate. I'm just trying to do my best to balance between, providing information, which is my responsibility to the residents that elected me, and making sure that I respect the legal process on the Attorney General side. So with regards to the names, I'm going to defer to the Attorney General on that.
Of course. And if you can't release names of the apparent perpetrators, what can you say about who did this?
Well, I mean, there were two actors. It seems that they are residents of Jersey City, and I'm sure that more information on that will come out. But, the one thing that I did put out there is, absent information, people make assumptions, unfortunately. And, they begin to question whether there's some jihadist intent or some or they were of the Muslim faith. And the one thing that I wanted to make sure that people understand is that at this stage of the investigation, there's nothing to support that. Jersey City has one of the largest Muslim communities in New Jersey, and we're very proud of that, and we're lucky to have them here. And we want to make sure that they feel that we have their support and we support them as well.
But there are indications of anti-Semitic postings by the perpetrator or perpetrators. Is that correct?
But I don't want to get into the social media posts. What I can say is what I said earlier today, that if you look at the CCTV cameras, it's difficult to argue that they didn't specifically target that location. They calmly drove that van from the cemetery to the location, and they took out long rifles and began to shoot that location, which was a Jewish or kosher grocery store. That's where we are today. And I would just say that, I'm Jewish. I'm the descendant of Holocaust survivors. My family immigrated to this country. And I feel lucky to live in a place like Jersey City, which is diverse and has so many warm and welcoming communities. And I think that I just want to highlight that there is no place for hate in Jersey City. There never has been, and there never will be.
The New York Times, in an article that moved a short time ago, cites a law enforcement official familiar with the case saying that a suspect had published anti-Semitic and anti-police posts online. Can you give us any more on that?
Again, I'd like to be cautious and defer to the Attorney General on that, to give specifics on that. The important thing to me was that people don't jump to conclusions to think of one community was involved or one faith was involved. I think that as the story unfolds, there'll be a lot to this. One thing I do want to highlight, though, is, when the gunfire started, we had a walking post of two police officers one block south from there. And, the videos show that those two police officers ran towards the gunfire immediately. They sustained injuries as well. And, they didn't hesitate. And I think absent of their bravery running towards the gunfire, the perpetrators would not have been confined to that grocery store. And I think that there's going to be enough to support the fact that this could have been far, far worse. And the intent of the perpetrators was to have this far, far worse of a tragedy than what it already is.
This began at a cemetery where the detective was killed. Is that correct?
Yes, but there's still investigating information on that, so I'm going to defer to the Attorney General on that aspect as well.
Do you see this as part of any larger conspiracy or movement?
No, I think it's important to recognize that there are no additional threats that we have in Jersey City. We're going to increase presence, of course, we're doing what we have to do. But it's important to recognize that we don't see any other threats at this time.
Where was the kosher market in relation to the cemetery? How far away?
I mean, it's several blocks. It's a drive. And the van drove calmly to the location of the kosher grocery store. I mean, there was no urgency. They clearly went to that place, parked directly in front of it, and there were other people in the area. And they targeted those victims, is what it appears from the CCTV cameras. So, look, from my standpoint, I'm trying to make sure that Jersey City residents know the information that we can share within the confines of New Jersey state law. And at the same time, respecting the Attorney General and the governor, and not overstepping boundaries. But, the way I look at this, I mean, I have a responsibility to make sure that both the Jewish community understands what we see here and that people don't make assumptions about other communities here. And so that's what we're trying our best to make sure that we do throughout this conversation.
Since you identified yourself as Jewish, as well as the
yep.
mayor of Jersey City, I want to ask you very briefly about one other story in the news today, and I would totally understand if you don't want to comment on this yet. Maybe you're not familiar with it yet, but it's breaking that President Trump is expected to announce a decision today to officially define Judaism in the eyes of the federal government as a nationality and not
yeah.
just a religion. And this is supposed to make it easier to hold people responsible for what the Trump administration sees as anti-Semitic activity on campus under the Civil Rights Act, which protects nationality but not religion per se. But some Jews are worried about this, even worried that it's a first step toward something that in the, worst case, most apocalyptic scenario could wind up with something like Nazi Germany, where Jews aren't defined as American by the American government, but as a nationality. Have you seen this yet?
Well, I mean, I saw the news, and let me say that I view myself as American as anybody else. I served in the military. I volunteered to serve after 9/11. I left the job at Goldman Sachs to enlist in the Marine Corps the days afterwards. I love this country. I love the flag. And at the same time, I view myself as part of the Jewish faith, and that happens to be my religion. I think it's a slippery slope anytime that you start to reclassify identities and religion in order to achieve an end goal. You know, if people have differences with whether it be the BDS movement or people protesting on college campuses, there's a right way and a wrong way to confront that, and that's what our country's built on. So I would just say it's a dangerous direction that President Trump is going on. And as a Jewish American, I don't really identify with the policy change. To me, I am American first as my nationality, and Jewish is my faith.
Last question. With anti-Semitic incidents on the rise in our region and nationally, as it's well documented that they are, is there anything new that you feel you need to do as mayor of Jersey City after this incident, or just in the larger context of what's going on today, than the city has been doing so far?
You know, the unfortunate thing is that this happened in a place like Jersey City, which I think is synonymous with having so many different cultures. I mean, we're really known as being a melting pot. We're the home of Ellis Island, the golden door to America. And I don't think, or do we want this to define who we are as a community? We are doing outreach to all the different communities here in Jersey City, particularly the community that was most impacted by this, both geographically and religiously. And, you know, we're going to do the appropriate outreach for there. But Jersey City is a safe community, a loving community, an inclusive community. And we're just going through some struggles and hardship right now, but we'll get through it.
Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop, I know you must be unbelievably busy under the circumstances, and I know our listeners really appreciate a few minutes. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks a lot, Brian.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 14, 2019. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, things to share. Let us know. The number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We will be here on Monday. Totally forgot. We should have Clifford Thompson, Cowbell, will be with us on Monday. I was almost thinking I'm going to use a sound clip of Azor Savage, young transgender male. He identifies as male, young transgender male, who is with us, author, right here in Seattle. He spoke at Elliott Bay Books in November, right? Seems like it was just yesterday, but yeah, it was last month, November. And I was present. He came on the program at the beginning of the month. Our guest for Monday's program, Clifford Thompson, was at the same bookstore about 7 days after Azor Savage was there. I don't know how I missed it, because I think I already knew about Clifford Thompson's work at that time. Wasn't being mindful. But when Azor was with us, I told him, I said, I think a part of the reason, not totally, but I do think a part of the reason that whites are willing to come to Elliott Bay Books, which is right in the middle of Seattle, Capitol Hill, right in the heart of the city, and come out and have a really full audience. They said that was the biggest crowd they'd had for one of their book presentations in a while. I don't know how many people were there for Clifford Thompson. I'll ask him. But will be very supportive and have this book at Amazon and all the libraries and things and independent bookstores readily available and right on. Great job, Azor. And it is a great book about racism. But I said, I think white people would be much more palatable, much more receptive to a project by a non-white person with a white parent and then a non-white person who is transgender. I think they would be much more acceptable than just a black person, male or female, two black parents, four black grandparents, eight black great grandparents. I am not transgender. I am a male. I am a female. And I'm just here to talk about racism. not going to be excited. I don't know. We got a lot of things already at Elliott Bay Books. You have to get back to us. Get back to us in 2020, maybe 2021. We'll see. Clifford Thompson, I don't think he identifies as transgender, but I already told you, cowbell. That also, big impact, I could see. Why, and particularly if you write a book where you talk about your biracial children and being married to a white woman, how grand all of that is, and talk about how black people are professionals at talking about being victims of white people, well then, oh yeah, I can see how you could be at Elliott Bay Books to talk about racism. But Mr. Thompson should be with us on Monday to discuss his book, What It Is. Get the title right. What It Is. I have been reading it. I think I shared already. It's not a long book, you know. So I think it's like 175 pages approximately. Not too big. I don't think that's too big. I got past the 60-page point. So at this point, dang, I've read about a third of the book already. Like, you've read enough to get an impression at this juncture. And I said, wow. This book is supposed to be about interviews of whites who voted for Trump. I haven't read one interview about a white person. I'm a third of the way through the book. Like, what is going? Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Cowbell. Speaking of books, 2019 has been awful. Absolutely awful. In every possible way. Like, an absolutely terrible year from beginning to end, pretty much. I was trying to think of things that I've been excited about, and it was a very short list for this calendar year. One thing, very excited about, oh man, Princess posted on social media, of all things. I never get excited about anything on social media. She posts on social media, no name calling. She shares a book. What does Dr. Welsing say? Reading is more important than watching television. What book does she post? Rethinking Rufus, Sexual Violations of Enslaved Men, Thomas A. Foster, published 2019. I got that book immediately. Let me give you the title again. Rethinking Rufus, Sexual Violations of Enslaved Men, Thomas A. Foster. If you have been listening to The Cows for some time, you should know this name, Thomas A. Foster. Dr. Tommy Curry mentions him all the time. He wrote a report. I think I could probably pull it up on my computer. Let's see. Oh, there it is. Sexual, mentioned on this program so many times. This is the report. That's not the correct report. Let's see. You might have to give me a moment to pull it up from my other. Yep, I have it on my other drive. I've sent it to friends. I bet if I pulled it up from my email, I could share it. But Thomas A. Foster, his book, it's on the same theory, but it's an article. It's very short. It's like 10 pages or so. This is a full stop. I haven't even looked at the contents, anything, to see what the chapter titles are, anything. I was so excited because Dr. Curry has mentioned him so many times before and talking about this book, and I knew that this work was coming. Oh, thank you so much, Princess. One good thing for 2019. The first thing I did was to get the book. The second thing I did was to reach out to see if we could get him as a guest on the program, and I was able to speak to him, and we're trying to get a date and time, so hopefully he'll be able to come on the program and chat it up. I am just super, super excited and ready to dig in. This book, I guess, isn't super long. I have it in front of me. It's not the long. Delectable Negro is longer. The Man Knot is longer. It's to give scale if people have read those works. We did them both in the book club. Both where Delectable Negro is in my top 10. So this is not a super long text. You should be able to read it. Rethinking Rufus, Sexual Violations of Enslaved Men, Thomas A. Foster. Hopefully coming to The Cows shortly. Reading is more important than watching television. A few other things before we get to the callers. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the cows is constructive. Hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, you will see my PayPal in the top right corner. Much obliged for all the folks who have invested via PayPal. You can also utilize Cash App. The address, cash.app/$thecows, should be linked in the description. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested and kept the cows on air, broadcasting for nearly 11 years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can drop an email if you are not into all of the new gadgetry. We can get you a physical mailing address. You can also use Amazon.com. Wish list is there. It is listed under Gus T. Renegade. Enormous gratitude to all of the listeners who have nabbed items from my wish list over the past decade plus. I hope the cows has provided constructive content, accurate information on what white supremacy racism is, what it means to be classified as white, and things we should be doing to solve this problem immediately. Rethinking Rufus, Sexual Violations of Enslaved Men, Thomas A. Foster. Get that in one more time. All right, next on the list, the segment where they were talking about the situation in Naperville, Illinois. They were going to lynch the student. Boy, those young white lads, they sounded ignorant about racism, didn't they? So they were talking in that segment, and they had the black mother on, and she said that she just bursts into tears sometimes. She feels helpless. Mr. Fuller does use that term, attempted mother, attempted father, for a reason, attempted parents. That is the reason why. But she said she felt so helpless and what to do, and, you know, she said they were discouraging her taking her child out of that school. And that segment right there, talk about, you know, an ugly or an unpleasant 2019. That segment right there, every single time when we talk about being a parent and having children, what do you do, how you talk to them, and what's the best route to take, what's the best thing to do, metaphor, I always, without caveat, Gus T. does not have children. That is a reminder to myself and everybody else. Make sure that I am never on here sounding like I am giving out suggestions, recommendations about what to do, and this is how you raise a counter-racist soldier. I would be sounding just like that black mother in Naperville, whimpering, I don't know what to do. I feel helpless. What am I going to do? That is probably exactly how I would be sounding, struggling and just trying as best I can to, you know, do attempted parent, to do what you can as a parent. And again, that is why I played the segment. Dr. Wilson talked about throwaway children. That is counter-racism right there, being methodical and strategic with the production of offspring. We're not going to be reckless. We're going to think this through. We're going to think about this. Our child is not going to be in the Naperville public school system where they are plotting to lynch our child. That is not going to be us. What is our academic program going to look like for the next 15 years for our child? That is the counter-racist way of bringing life into the world under the system of white supremacy. Next. Let me go ahead and get that now. That their segment, they were talking about the schools. And they said that that young white child, she called black people chocolate ice cream. I stopped. I'll tell you exactly how it went. I was listening. I'm doing my editing, putting the audio together. She said, talk chocolate ice cream. I stopped and I did the cut right there. And we were going to do the rewind. We're going to do all that. And so I had it all together and I hadn't heard the rest of it. So I put it back and boop, we do the rewind, cause of chocolate ice cream. And then it went to,
We'd already had the conversation with the other instructor, and she said she didn't see a problem with this because she calls black people Tootsie Rolls. And I said, oh, man, I got to recut. Whoa, we missed out. Got to get all of that. And I said, we got a double whammy there, Mr. Fuller. Why is the Delectable Negro? Wait a minute. Let me give the full title. It is The Delectable Negro, Homoeroticism and Human Consumption in U.S. Slave Culture, full title. That is why that is in the top. Well, that's one of many reasons why that book is in the top 10, why we read that in the book club 2017. Also an unpleasant year. Most of them are in the system. But we did read Delectable Negro, top 10. Why would you be referring to, you know, the Negro, the coon, the inferior black? Why would you be referring to them? We were just having a problem about lynching them, maybe castrating them too. Why would you then come back and refer to these same people as chocolate ice cream? They can't keep chocolate ice cream on the shelves sometimes, especially in the summer, right? You've seen that where the whites go crazy about the chocolate ice cream. Why would that be a name? Tootsie Rolls, from even remembering Valerian, the streets from Tar Baby, the candy, white empire, racist empire of candy. Why would you be referring to black people, a candy that's been popular for so long, for generations of cavities? Why would you be referring to black people by these names as though you want to devour them? What is going on with that, Delectable Negro, Homoeroticism and Human Consumption in U.S. Slave Culture, Vincent Woodard? It is in the archives. Reading more important than watching television. And I think that book mentions Thomas A. Foster. I would be willing to bet quite a few shillings that Thomas A. Foster's book is in there. That's where I could get the title of the article I was looking for. Moving forward. Let's see. In that same segment, can't even move it. There were so many reports on school this week, right? That's why I said I do not have children. They told that mother, who was in tears, they told her, no, we don't think it's a good idea for you to move your child. We want to discourage that. In fact, we think it would be best for your child to learn how to handle these situations. Go ahead and toughen him up. What kind of nonsense is that? Now, pause. This is where, all right, now let's do the metaphors. Let's do the comparison. So if it was a transgender white student and they were being called names and teased about that, would it be, oh, no, you shouldn't remove your, we want to toughen them up now. Come on. What's going on with that? That's what the response would be. If it was a young Jewish child and they were being teased, they were picking on them, making fun of what happened in the Jersey situation. You should have been there. You should have been shot too. Ha 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 ha. That's the response. It's, oh no, just tell they need to learn how to deal with this. This will toughen it. This will set them up so they can be a productive citizen. That's what we want. This is good to build character. Everybody needs to, you know, experience how to deal with being told they want to be lynched. Again, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. When you do not sit down and have a conversation before conception, what is our child's academic program going to look like for the first 15 years of their life? You don't do that. That's what's going to happen. That's what the academic program is going to be. Toughening up your child, we will tease them and threaten to lynch them. That's character building for the Negro child in 21st century America. Next, they had so many metaphors, but I'll get to that. When they talked about the criminal justice reform, so-called, and they were talking about the minors who had committed crimes and been locked up, I felt like we just talked about that with Gavin DeBecker, The Gift of Fear. He had that whole section about minors who have committed crimes, and a lot of it focused on the black male, where they changed all the laws in New York and named the law after him, I think. They talked about that segment. For some reason, my mind went to Mr. Fuller He was talking about Tukey Williams, who is not necessarily in that situation, but directly, because I don't think he was a minor when he was incarcerated. But anyway, he talked about Tukey Williams and other folks. Mr. Fuller has zero remorse, unless he has changed his view or my memory is really bad. And I'm very certain it's not on this one, because I was it was significant. I listened quite a few times intently to hear him explain. But Mr. Fuller does not have a lot of remorse. In fact, has zero remorse for black people who commit crimes. And especially if we're talking about fatal crimes, murder, fatally violent crimes against other black people. He does not have a lot of remorse. He is not on that. Oh, yes. You know, let's be compassionate. No. People who have heard him talk about what his compensatory prison would be like, and you just being there by yourself and you killed this person, so that's what you need to do to yourself. Like, that is his view strong. Like, he is not interested in any of that. Like, no, we are not pardoning Tukey Williams. That's what you did. Oh, well, you'll be hanging out there. I mean, zero. And I think some of that is because he's just seen so much black life lost, black people being violent with other black people. That's why I think he discourages that so strongly. But he does not have remorse for that sort of thing. Next, we are reading Mumia Abu-Jamal for a reason. Live from Death Row, we did the first study session on Thursday. We are reading Mumia Abu-Jamal for a reason. 50-year anniversary of Fred Hampton. I am sure that was not talked about in a major capacity over the past week. And for him to eloquently, from greater confinement, to have been there so long and to do so in such an eloquent manner with all of the detail as only a former Black Panther Party member could do. But there is a reason we are reading live from Death Row Mumia Abu-Jamal, second installment on Thursday this coming week. One thing from last week, we'll do our metaphors and then we'll get our callers. There are several things that I am not, I mean, VGQ, we all have different views, perspectives on racism, but one thing that one thing that I have little patience or tolerance for having to hear, when victims of racism get frustrated, when we have been abused and it goes to counter violence, generally I'm not interested in hearing non-white people talk about counter violence, because most of the time it's not very codified. Frequently it's not even logical. A lot of times it'll be a lot of emotion. And everybody is emotional. Humans are emotional. Gus T is emotional frequently. I was teary-eyed just listening to that black mother in Illinois talking about being helpless. It's emotional. That being said, I do not want my emotion to drive my speech when it comes to counter racism and especially counter violence. And one of the reasons that I don't have a lot of patience for hearing victims talk about counter violence, I'll give an example with Trayvon Martin. In hearing people call in, some of this is in the Cal's archives, call in, if I was Trayvon Martin's parents, you know, that would have been me. I would have killed everyone in Sanford, or, you know, hunted down Trayvon Martin's killer, blah, 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 blah. There was a lot of that, and I can tolerate generally about 5 seconds of that. Number one, I don't think it's intelligent or logical in black identity extremist era, COINTELPRO era, really any era of white supremacy, I don't think it's intelligent to speak publicly about that sort of thing. I think when Micah Xavier Johnson was accused of having killed enforcement officers in Dallas, Texas, in 2016, I think there was some effort to say, well, man, he was connected to Professor Griff. What did he have to do with this? They'll be looking for all kinds of obscure connections. You probably want to avoid, when it comes to counter violence, doing any sort of public talking about that sort of thing. I know Mr. Fuller, according to his counter racist code, with maximum emergency compensatory action, one of the major components is not talking about it, not broadcasting it, if it gets to the point where counterviolence needs to be enacted, well, then the time for chatting is done. Even if it's getting close to that point, that's probably not the sort of thing I would want to be talking about publicly or on a social media site, public radio platform. That would be one. One of the other reasons, and this also, there are many reasons why I have very little tolerance for hearing this sort of conversation. One of the other reasons is that this conversation generally gets to some permutation of black people are cowards, even if that's not stated directly. It generally gets to that point, some way, somehow, that all of the really courageous warrior black people are dead, whatever that means. Black people don't fight back. If black people were really about something, you know, such and such would be dead, or this person would be dead. All of that is worthless. If black people are that lame and we deserve all of this, then again, nothing should be said. We should just accept, you know, whatever happens. Black people are lame chumps. We deserve what we get. And now, the other component is what I've said consistently, especially if it comes to codification and being codified for counterviolence. The person that you have the most knowledge about there being codified is yourself. Especially when it comes to counterviolence, that is never something where I'm pointing at anybody else other than the mirror when it gets to counterviolence and having a code, what should be done, what shouldn't be done. I'm talking about me, nobody else. I'm not out here wagging my finger about we need to have a code and black people need to have a code. No. If I think that's what needs to be done, Dylann Roof showed us the way. Dylann Roof didn't come out here and get on a podcast and say, man, white team, what is wrong with you all? Get it together. We got coons running all over Charleston. Something needs to be done about it. If Jesse Jackson is alive tomorrow, he didn't do all that. In fact, he did what he did. And then the manifesto was released where he said, I'm tired of all the talking. Y'all are sitting around doing all Wolf tickets. That's the old one. I'm tired of y'all doing all this. Something needs to be done. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to do it. That is application when it gets to counterviolence. All of that chatting about what needs to be done, what I would like to see done, that is worthless. And at minimum, I have zero tolerance for all of that. If that is your view, well, then you can get to work on your counter-racist code. And again, according to what Mr. Fuller said, and I see the value of that, even if you carry it out, even then, it shouldn't be talked about. There shouldn't be a note, no discussion. It was done, and that's that. Showing much more powerful than just talking. With that, the metaphors were plentiful in the audio segment this week. Man, we had fish out of water. That was with the white man with a black child. Sexually sewering. That's what he said about his black child. He's often a fish out of water. And they were going to the rodeo. I said, my goodness, Dr. Welsing, are they going to the rodeo? The white man with his black child, they're going to the rodeo? Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. We had the school and their poor response to the lynching that they have blind spots. I don't know what that means. Seems like they could insert a racist Stevie Wonder joke or Ray Charles joke somewhere in there. But I have no idea what that means when it comes to racism, white supremacy, and people having blind spots. Presumably calling black people ice cream, chocolate ice cream, and Tootsie Roll, presumably those would be metaphors too, even though, you know, that's delectable Negro. Those would be special metaphors. But those are metaphors. Those are metaphors. At minimum, the metaphor should be interrogated. System of racism, white supremacy, they frequently are transmitting white supremacy, racism ideas, concepts, making sure that that power equation of white dominating non-white is always there. And it seems like a lot of times they also seem to be conveying that there is something tasty, delectable about black people. Chocolatey. In addition to all of that, frequently the metaphors are also used to be deceptive, so the blind spots, so that we're not being accurate in terms of white people being dedicated to practicing white supremacy racism. It'll be articulated as white people have blind spots or they're ignorant. This is not accurate. White people will also use similes, analogies, comparisons to take two separate concepts and insist that they are identical, exactly the same. Frequently, this is not the case. This is just master deception. Victims, myself included, we've been exposed to this misconduct for a long time. Many of us also, we are still learning, myself included. As such, sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our views. We will then substitute a metaphor, analogy, comparison of some sort. Frequently, this contributes to more confusion. If we could be exact, precise with what it is we like to say, that would be appreciated. If you need more time to think about what you want to say, that is always allowed. I have to do that myself. I've done it today. That is always allowed. I will prompt about the metaphors. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, that would be grand. Make sure everybody has at least one opportunity to speak. If you need extra time, just allow everyone their one chance, and then you can share additional questions, comments, or suggestions. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be great, just so that we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary noise. It helps preserve the audio quality of the broadcast. When you're ready to talk, if you can get to a quiet area, share your thoughts, and then mute your line. And then if you need to share again, have other comments, grant, you can unmute and you'll be ready to roll. But that is always appreciated. Much obliged. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The last thing I'll get in. That food window segment was the first thing that we started with. I had heard that report before about having a food window. You don't necessarily have to fast all day, but at minimum, not eating all day long type thing. That is one of the adjustments that I made very early on. I think that was one of the adjustments that I made before I even transitioned my diet back to being vegan, was having that what they call food window, meaning that you have a 10-hour period during the day where you eat, and then once that 10-hour period closes, you no longer eat until the next day, and you can set the 10 hours whenever you want. I normally do my 10-hour window is like noon to 10 p.m., generally, especially with my yoga, because I don't like eating before I do yoga, so that way I can practice in the morning. And then once I'm done practicing, then I can eat. So I start eating a little bit later. And then also I can have a later dinner so that I can eat at 8, 9 o'clock. That's normally about the time that I eat. Sometimes eating after the program so that I can eat later in the day. But that's still 10-hour window. And it's still not late because that is the worst. Like, you want an example of not doing all of that. And I mean, like 12:30, 1 o'clock at night. Ribs, let's do it, all with the rolls, brownies, ice cream, you name it. 1:30 in the morning. How to be tubby in 2019. That is it. I was going to use a metaphor, but absolutely. I have lived it, not doing that way. And that is exactly how you end up being. Everything that they said, all of the health problems that they mentioned, check, done all of that. That was one of the first things that I changed, because I did hear that report some years ago about the same time that I started doing yoga. That was one of the first things that I changed, and that did make a difference. Not just eating all day long and sticking to that. This is going to be my 10-hour window, and once we're done eating, we're done eating. It's not going to be any running back and snacking and getting this and eat what you're going to eat. This is it. And they said you don't even have to change anything. You can eat same things that you already eat, do all that, but just stick to that. This is the 10-hour window. Try that out and see how you feel. Does it make an impact? That one is something that I stick to even now, and something that I started almost simultaneously with my yoga practice. There was a reason that clip was included. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. clicked the wrong button. Sorry about that. You have to give me a moment as I get myself together on the switchboard. Okay. Folks who dialed in with the hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Oh, wait a minute. One of our investors, I wasn't looking at the switchboard. Red Now in Ohio got me my spiralizer. I did my cooking today. I did the veggie lo mein with, I used my spiralizer, courtesy of Red, my wish list. I used my spiralizer with golden beets, bok choy, broccoli, carrots, mushroom. I used Guardian. They have a veggie chicken I used for the first time. Wasn't that big a fan. Would have actually been better without that in there. But, wow. Really, really good. Fresh ginger, sesame oil. Wow. Really good. And not difficult to make at all. Tastes like lo mein, but just made with beets instead of the actual lo mein noodles. So it's all vegetable based. Really good. Finding different ways to use my spiralizer. Eat more veggies. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Good evening to you guests, callers and guests. It's Bea in Toronto.
Greetings.
Yes, just to include for the mom who was worried and feeling helpless because there are people in the school that were planning on how to lynch her son, you're absolutely correct. I mean, there isn't situations where, you know, even in, say, a child molestation situations where they say, oh, you know, keep that child in that same situation, it'll toughen them up. I mean, with racism, it seems to be, it appears to be the only crime in which it seems okay for the perpetrators to continue their terrorism so that victims can be toughened up. And it's counterintuitive. And I hope that the mom is able to remove her son out of the school system, get out of that area if possible, or at least work towards it. The second thing that caught my attention was in regards to the shooting at the Jewish grocery store. In that snippet, they discussed about how they were talking about possibly categorizing Jewish people as a nationality because they are targets of anti-Semitism. Semitics do not only include the European Jews. It includes an array of people that are including Muslims. And it's really interesting that the person who was talking was saying that they're an American first, because that's really was a coded word for white. Jews became white a little bit after 1945. So if they were to change to being identified according to their religion as opposed to white, their white status will be revoked eventually, as soon as they make that change, which actually leads to the expansion of my theory, which I really actually think is fact, of whites being extremists. So when pale people who identify themselves as white, they have to subscribe to the terms and conditions of being white, of which that's what the Jews essentially did, along with the Irish, the Italians, those who were formerly not considered white as before. And it includes willfully thinking and using terms and engaging in behaviors within their culture, that culture of doing, that are extremist and in support of white supremacy. So the white extremist doesn't necessarily have to go, say, into a church and shoot non-white people, or they don't necessarily have to go and beat someone up. They could just be practicing racism, because racism is based on extremist outcomes. For them to be rich, non-whites need to be poor. For them to feel good about themselves, non-whites have to be put down. For them to feel so-called safe, then non-whites have to be killed or abused in some form or fashion, in particular Black people that they've categorized. So just keeping that in mind. And the definition of extremist, I couldn't find an appropriate definition. So the one that I've come up with, and it's still a working one in under construction, is to participate or incorporate in all aspects of life, perceptions, ideologies, and deceptions, adamantly and with or without inquiry, regardless of whether there is partial or complete understanding of white supremacy. So that's what I classified as extremist within the white extremist context. Thank you, and I leave the line.
Much obliged. Be in Toronto. Always appreciate folks looking to clarify terms and refining definitions if they are not appropriate in order to reveal truth. Others who dialed in with a hand up, if you have questions, suggestions, comments to share, proceed. Okay, well, while folks are getting there, thoughts together, I will make sure I get in. The New York Times had a report just published just a couple days ago. It was about the shooting in New Jersey. I thought this was important as well. It was titled, I posted it, I shared it already, Black Hebrew Israelites, What We Know About the Fringe Group. We'll even do a pause. Let's fringe. What does that mean? An ornamental border of threads left loose or formed into tassels or twists. Or material. Let's see. Boop. Let's see if we can get a better definition for fringe. Oh, okay. Lots of definitions. I'd say be leery of any of the words that have lots of definitions. Natural border of hair. The outer marginal or extreme part of an area, group, or sphere of activity. His uncles were on the fringes of crooked activity. Look at that. That's even that word crooked for people who have spirally hair. That's interesting. But that, I think, is the definition that they're using. Fringe. The outer margin and marginalized people. Isn't that what they call some groups? Some of, anyway. The extreme part of an area, group, or sphere of activity. That's fringe. All right, so back to the report. Black Hebrew Israelites, what we know about the fringe group. Black Hebrew Israelites are known for their inflammatory sidewalk ministers who employ provocation as a form of gospel, preaching a theology that says the chosen ones are Black, Native American, and Hispanic people. They capitalized every so-called group there except for Black. I don't capitalize Black either. I'm just pointing that out. Now it has emerged that one of the two suspects in Tuesday's attack on a kosher market in Jersey City that ended with the death of six people, including a police officer, appears to have been connected to the group, a law enforcement official said. The suspect, David N. Anderson, 47, was killed inside the JC Kosher supermarket, along with the second suspect, Francine Graham, 50, official said. Mr. Anderson, the law enforcement official said, had posted anti-Semitic and anti-police screeds on internet forums in the past. Some idiot just said something about posting. Yeah. A manifesto-style document was found in the van that assailants abandoned in the parking lot of the supermarket, but the official said it was rambling and gave no clear motivation for the attack. The belief system of Black Hebrew Israelites, a sect that is not associated with mainstream Judaism, varies among the dozens of groups into which the century-old theology has splintered over the years. Broadly speaking, followers reject the notion of race and instead believe that the tribes of Israel defined in the Old Testament are different ethnic groups or nations and that whites are not among them. They mostly trade in anti-Semitism. They view Jews as imposters, said Heidi Barrick, the director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, that's a pause right there. We've had representatives of that organization as a guest on this program, and very recently, I believe this calendar year, they were reportedly accused of practicing racism, white supremacy themselves. The non-white staff members said that the hiring practices, the workplace racism, promotion practices, and the way that the group functioned internally, who made the decisions, was focused mostly with white men, and accused them of practicing racism in other ways as well. But they get to be the authority on the fringe hate group known as the Black Hebrew Israelites. Continuing, SPLC tracks extremist groups and has labeled Black Hebrew Israelites as a hate group because it says their ideology is informed by bigotry. They call them sometimes devilish imposters or devils because they think of themselves as the true Israelites. Miss Barrick added the group is not known for committing mass acts of violence. It doesn't have a record of violence that white supremacists have in the United States. I'll stop there. They go on to give more about them posting hate on social media. Other folks who dialed in that the black identity extremists, that was what I said, any individual classified as black, oh yeah, you can be labeled a black identity extremist. You are affiliated with this here group. You and Mr. Anderson were online, probably in some chat forum together, talking about, you know, talking bad about the police and white people. Other folks we've missed totally. If you have a hand up, comments to share, questions, suggestions, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Ohio.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. When you were mentioning your spiralizer, I'd actually made some non-dairy Alfredo, and I used the Vio light cheese, and it wasn't bad. So I think that's probably another one of the vegan brands that I would definitely suggest people use. I just have a few observations this week. The first one, when you were speaking about the segment where a child was called Tootsie or something like that, is actually in reference to workplace racism. I had overheard a conversation between a manager, a non-white black manager, and a white man who is actually a lower position than this black manager. The white man had put like some type of note or something on this black person's desk referencing them as Pepsi. So it made me think of, you know, the person's name, not anywhere close to being Pepsi or anything like that. They just decided to do that. And the black person, because the black person didn't know who at first put the note on their desk, and they immediately went to that person. But I guess they kind of have some type of rapport. And so they kind of, you know, had a laugh about it. But that same white man was one of the two white people who were discussing what I spoke about it several weeks ago about the black male in Central Ohio. He was in Westerville who had killed the two law enforcement officials and how that was such a horrible thing that he got to live instead of getting the death penalty. So that was one of those two suspected racists. The next thing was actually on the clip about the Jewish people becoming a nationality, possibly. I never quite understood how some white people, they will say that when you ask them if they're white, they'll say that they're Jewish, or they will come out if something is referencing race, they'll automatically reference themselves as being Jewish instead of how they would, you know, identify on any form or anything like that as being white, as if that is, I don't know, a classification, a racial classification, which I never could understand. But then, like, when that white man has said he is a Jewish American, I don't really hear people referring to themselves as Christian Americans, or I think maybe a few times I maybe heard of someone say a Muslim American, but, you know, Seventh-day Adventist American, I don't hear any other type of religious denominations referencing themselves as something before, you know, referencing their religion before they reference their nationality. So I always thought that that was maybe a way for them to, you know, practice deception. And then a few things, another thing that happened, I was in the grocery store and I decided to go through like the checkout line with the cashier, and it was this suspected young white racist man, and he was done ringing up my items, and then his voice volume was normal throughout the whole, I don't know, the time that he was ringing up everything. And then once he got towards the end, he has asked me if I wanted to hear a joke, and I'm not paying attention. I said, I heard, like, did you want to hear a joke? And I said, what? And I heard something about a joke. And then he proceeded with the first part of the joke. And then the punchline was weird, or, you know, tacky and trashy or whatever. But he stretches out his forearm, and he had some word written on his forearm, but he covers up like the last part of it with his thumb. And so all I see on his forearm is FU. And I'm like, I've never seen this white man before in my life. Don't have any type of rapport. I usually don't ever go through the checkout stands or whatever, but I did decide to send in a complaint to the corporate office. So that was just one of the tacky and trashy observations that I, you know, or things that I had to deal with this week. And then the last thing, I know, I guess it might have been like a few weeks back or something like that, when you're talking about Jim Jones, I did decide to start listening to the audiobook Road to Jonestown. I do think it's really interesting. It does provide more information, of course, than the documentaries that I've seen. And the most important thing that I have been able to gather from the book, besides the fact that Jim Jones was a pedophile, bisexual, adulterer, but he was, that book really details more about how he was a thief. He kept making his followers go out and ask for donations, especially when they got to Guyana, when he had the equivalent of about $30 million in the bank. And that was from, you know, of course, him making his followers sign over houses and stuff like that. But it also described like the hierarchy of his followers that he wanted to go to Guyana. And the hierarchy was he wanted the people who would have like social security checks, disability checks, things like that. And they were mainly older black females. They also talked about Father Divine, which I wasn't that aware of. Father Divine, he was a black male who essentially was like a, I guess you could call him like a mega church priest, pastor. And he also got his followers to give him a lot of money. And so Jim Jones basically was trying to take his style of preaching and apply it to his own and kind of gather up that same power. And it almost made me think of like Delectable Negro, because Jim Jones didn't have his, he wasn't as like altruistic, I guess, as most documentaries and most times I hear about things about him as people try to make him seem. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Red in Ohio. Very sorry you had to deal with that. Just trying to go out and do a little shopping, but black self-respect for making the report to corporate. And I know sometimes that's a hassle because that's more time and energy. You got to invest and sit down and write and all of that. But I do think it's important. Frequently in those type of situations, you can get compensated for, you know, whatever, your time and energy. So you might be compensated. You might get some sort of reimbursement for that. Certainly, I wouldn't expect for anyone to be terminated or anything of that nature. But, you know, I still think it's good practice to report in those types of situations. Let's see. I thought the nationality thing was important as well, but I'm sure other people will have comments on that. Other folks that we've missed totally, if you have comments, questions you would like to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I heard your report on Mr. Fuller, and I have heard Mr. Fuller very clearly in the way that you described. I would say that probably some of the evidence of his thoughts is because he was robbed at gunpoint one time. He described quite thoroughly. I think that has something to, that may have something to do with it also on his thoughts on a non-white person murdering another non-white person because he was a victim of an armed robbery himself. And he said that that was the most frightened he was ever he ever experienced. And he mentioned that even more so than him doing combat in Korea, that particular incident that he was had the unfortunate to be involved in was the most frightening in his life. ECS program. The program went again to a greater confinement facility. I chose to not go this time. It, as I mentioned before, I haven't thoroughly processed the reasoning on to go. I would be much more comfortable in a situation to whereas, let's say, some of the non-white people who are in greater confinement are allowed through quote unquote furlough to come and visit whomever, you know, an organization of, you know, similar to a DCS program, that sort of thing, as opposed to going into greater confinement. It's just something that I can't really articulate it thoroughly even now, but it's just something that, I don't have interest into going in, and I see it on YouTube a lot, this phrase, quote unquote, scared straight. But I haven't really seen any thorough constructive results on it. Maybe someone can tell me about some sort of factual constructive results on it. I haven't seen it as far as that concerned, but that's basically it. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. The scared straight, they have, it's like an older concept. When I say older, like 50 years or so, might even be older than that, but taking younger people into greater confinement is, like, oh my goodness, I could end up here. I better, you know, behave and go to church and brush my teeth and all that. But I think it's old enough that I think they have done studies. And I think that they have said that in some cases it is counterproductive, because what the opposite happens is that they go and say, oh my gosh, these were the coolest fellas I've ever seen in my life. I want to be just like them. So, you know, it's I think it is debatable whether or not, you know, that is a productive investment of time or a way to try to get young people to do the correct thing. And I think logic, I suspect, is dictating why you felt uncomfortable or uninterested in wanting to go to greater. I think most logical thinking individuals. No, thank you. I'm not really interested in going to greater confinement on a Saturday or any day, actually. But thank you. Thank you for the offer. I'm good.
Right.
Did you have more, sir? Was that it?
No, that's it. You're accurate on your assessment also, I think. And as I mentioned before, if I had to just come up with a plan, it would be the opposite, that some young people of equivalent age, they would be allowed to come from the greater confinement on a bus to an area where the children that so-called that are being suggested not to go to, you know, don't do nothing that'll get you to go to prison. You know, it should be in the opposite direction. They should be able to come to that particular place, that sort of thing. I think it should be the opposite, if anything, if the two meet. That's it.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Give out the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I saw a documentary. They were talking about yoga. It was on Bikram, very popular. In fact, the ESPN podcast series on Bikram came out exactly when I started my yoga teacher training. And then they mentioned him the very first week of teacher training. They were talking about sexual misconduct. That's what his documentary is all about. But I watched it. And in addition to all these accusations that this fellow Bikram molested and sexually terrorized all of these mostly white women, they said that he practiced, I was going to say racism, but I think he's non-white. I'd have to investigate. But they said that he practiced racism. And they had, obviously, it wasn't a whole lot of black yogis there, but they had a black female. She was there. And she talked about how he called her, you know, black this and blah, 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 and cursed her out and all this other stuff. I was like, wow, what? Black people just cannot win. But I did catch that. I had not heard anything about a specific mistreatment of black people. Everything had just been about all these white female victims, but anti-blackness yet again. Other folks that we have missed totally, I guess I'll get in my obligatory request if we could not wait until the last minute. If you think you might have something to share, don't wait until the very end. Go ahead and get a hand up. That is not cool. The people who wait until it's 3 minutes left in the program and then decide that they have a good 10 things that they want to share. That is, yeah. Let us go. Other folks, we've missed totally.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Gus. Good evening to you and all the listeners and callers. I have a doozy of a situation to share with you. I'm going to try to keep my emotions in check. But I want to first start off by saying I am so grateful for you and the Kyle's program, all your hard work, your dedication, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., and the grandsister, Dr. Francis Press Walsing. So I had an incident this week with a police And because of my counter-racist code, it didn't get totally, you know, horrible. But it's pretty horrible, but it didn't end up with me being accosted, but no less emotionally scarred. So my son had a performance at his school. The retired firefighter would be familiar with this area of Pembroke Pines. My son attends a school in Florida in Pembroke Pines, and he had a musical performance. He was in the band. So we get there, me and some of my family, and I saved a seat for my daughter who was running late. Performance started at 7. This is about 7:20. She's texting me. I'm parking. I'm like, all right, come on in. 7:22 precisely, she calls me and says, Mom, can you please come out and tell them that you have a seat for me? They're not wanting to let me in. So I'm just kind of strolling outside expecting to just see some faculty member to say, hey, my daughter, I have a seat. Good to go. Let her in. But I am greeted by a very hostile law enforcement person, white male, and your daughter is very rude, very rude, very rude and disrespectful, very rude. And I'm like, whoa, I mean, it caught me off guard. I wasn't expecting that type of encounter. So I just said very calmly, okay, well, I have a seat for her. So she needs to come on in. He goes, oh, she's not coming in. She's not coming in. She's not coming in. And I'm like, excuse me? She's not coming in. I'm detective. And he threw his name out there really fast. And I said, well, what law did she break? She didn't break any law, but if she has a bad attitude, she's not coming in. He doesn't work at the school. He's not the school resource officer, but the school resource officer was standing right there behind him. I've seen him there at the school a number of occasions. So I said to him, then he says, well, and the principal says that we're at capacity and that to not let anyone in due to fire code issues. It was really crowded inside. You did have some family people standing up around, so at the back. So I said, well, as I'm standing there, I'm blocking the gate to go out. So I realized there's a family behind me. So I said, oh, I'm sorry. And they proceed to leave. I go, well, a lot of people are leaving, thus making more room. And so now that the resource officer yells out very aggressive, it's a fire code, ma'am. And I'm like, whoa. At that same moment, I'm not really even paying attention to all the people passing by. This white woman chooses to interject herself into the situation and goes, oh, yeah, it's really crowded. I was standing on the back wall. It is very crowded inside. And I looked at her and said, ma'am, I know what's going on inside. I don't need your help. So continue on with your family. All of her family had already walked. She chose to jump in my situation. This person with a badge has the nerve to then say, oh, I can see the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And I go, excuse me? Well, I said, I don't need her help. Why is she interjecting in this situation? Oh, she was just being courteous. I said, I don't need her courteous. I don't need her chiming in. I'm an adult. You're an adult. We're dealing with this as adults. I don't need her help. Well, ma'am, doesn't matter. She's not coming in. So at this moment, my emotion, my heart's racing. As you can imagine, I'm feeling powerless. I'm feeling like if I continue to argue, he's going to now tell me he doesn't like my attitude and I need to leave. Or put us in handcuffs. I mean, so many scenarios are running through your mind at that moment that I look at my daughter and I said, just go home. We will deal with it. It was her first time going to be able to see her brother perform. She was devastated. So she's looking at me and she goes, I want to. And I'm like, calm down. So she turns around. I said, go home. He's up now. I need to get back inside. So I'm torn to stay there with her, comfort her, get back inside. So right as I turn to leave, she calls to me, and I come back to the fence. And I'm telling you guys, it felt like how I've described it. We're talking through the fence like we're like at Shawshank Redemption is how I described it. We're talking through the gate, and she's like, Mom, I'm shaking. And I'm like, look at me, calm down, keep your emotions in check. Take breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth. I'm walking her through some anxiety moment. And big, her eyes are welling up with tears, and she's like, I just wanted to see my brother perform. And I'm like, I know, but we're powerless right now. What do we do? Do we fight? Do we get arrested? Like, what are we going to make this problem a bigger problem? And all I can hear is your voice solving problems without creating new problems. I wanted to cry, but I had to stay strong for her. She turns around, and I go, we will talk about it. This isn't the end of it. Just go. So she goes back. I go back inside. My mom's like, what's going on? And I'm like, just give me a moment. And now my leg is shaking. I'm taking deep breaths myself, trying to decompress about what just happened. A few minutes later, I'm looking around. I see the same person with a badge come in. He's scanning the room, looking around, and I promise it felt like he was looking for me. You know, was he looking for me? Is he going to kick me out? And, I mean, after the performance, I made a beeline to the principal, who was a non-white black male, but, I mean, that's in these situations, neither here nor there sometimes. And I tell him what happened. He apologizes profusely, but he says he did tell them that due to fire code. And I said, okay, but at what point were you not letting anyone else in? When it was 5 over the capacity, when it was 10 over, when it was 20 over, like I had a seat for her. She wasn't going to be standing up on the wall, you know? And so I will be pushing it further. I went to the police department to make a complaint. I do know many good, close family friends who work in law enforcement, who are sergeants, who work in IA. They told me the language I need to use to write my my complaint. And one of the key things they said that I should write is that he did not use tact in consideration is a key word. Point out that he did not try to de-escalate the situation, but in fact escalated it due to his belligerence and of the insult. And they all were shocked when I told them about the apple doesn't fall far from the tree comment, that they said that all the years that they've been law enforcement, been on scenes where the family is acting irate, they have never used that type of inflammatory language. So, I my heart's beating now even telling you about it, because it's real. When these situations happen, they can go so quickly to a level that you don't, you know, unless you have that constant listening and reading and studying. And it's funny because all this week I've been listening to the archives to your, when you went to the White Privilege Conference, and I listened to all the archive tapes as well as the follow-up with Dr. Willie Moore. So it really helps. So if you, other listeners who are listening, listen all the time, not just on, you know, Saturdays, not just on Wednesdays, but listen all the time in your car, because it will help you when you are faced with these situations on how to respond. And I will mute my line. Thank you.
Wow. Solving problems without creating new problems. Very important. I try to keep that in the forefront of my thinking as often as possible. Not creating new problems as we solve the problems we already have that are considerable in number. Wow. So I don't forget, man, oh man, that White Privilege Conference. Woo! La Crosse, Wisconsin. I remember it like it was yesterday. My goodness. And Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., when he came back on the program the second time, that was when he threatened to punch me in the nose. If you go back and listen, I think you have to get through. Justice asked some great questions on that one as well. But, woo! to get through all of that and all that about, you know, the white privilege conference is not about beating up on white people and blah, blah, blah. Man, that gut, you know how you have some coons, you just want to punch them in the nose sometimes. Like, what in the world?
I was listening keenly for that moment, and when it happened, I laughed in my car so hard. I was like, there it is. There's the threat. Wow. Wow.
Whew. I mean, Gus T. Renegade, I do. Hey, I think there's a long line of people who have expressed similar thought. If Gus T. lived someplace closer than Seattle, I would be in line to punch him in the nose. So I'm sure Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. is not alone. But I thought nonviolent. Anyway, with the situation with your daughter, again, I don't have children. That right there. I mean, I don't even have words just to say I'm sorry you had to deal with that. Your daughter had to deal with that does not seem to do it justice. Because, I mean, that's a total incident of terrorism. Like, just for you, for your daughter, she's there. I'm just trying to support my brother and his performance. And you know, all this, like, I can't go. You've got a seat, you know, for me and everything. And ah, get out of here. She's got a terrible attitude. Ah. And then, you know, Mr. Fuller says on a pretty regular basis, expect to be mistreated. And really having that in the forefront of my mind on a regular basis, at least for me, often can help me stay somewhat calm in those situations, because I don't go in thinking that, oh, you know, they're going to treat me like I'm a respected member of this school. And, you know, they value, you know, what I have to say, and they want to make sure that I'm treated well. And they're going to no. I don't think that way. And it would be agonizing to have to train my child to think that way. So
it really is. You know, another thing that crossed my mind that I found so odd, and I will be pointing this out in my complaint. You know, they said that to make it a formal complaint, don't settle for the "oh, we'll talk to him" line, but make sure that it goes in his file. But it's funny because any other situation, when people are nearby chiming in, don't they typically say, please keep walking. We don't need you over
right
here. Do not interfere. Do not interject. Now I'm being, you know, made to feel like I did something wrong because I didn't accept this white woman's help. Now, I'm not going to say that in my report, white woman, but I will point out another, you know, this another woman, whatever, but isn't that something, you know, and all that. And the funny thing, Gus, I could hardly sleep that night. It just kept replaying in my mind. Should I have said this? Should I have pointed this out? Should I have stood my ground? You know, what would have happened? It was very traumatizing. I called my daughter a few minutes after she left. She was in the car crying. Like, Mom, it was, and she says, I was not rude. She says, the only thing, I was trying to defend myself to let them know you had a seat for me, and they were getting so nasty that, you know, she put a little concern because they know I listen. I have the cows playing on speaker. I hook it up to the speaker in the house so they can hear it. So they know that I'm constantly on this journey. And so I said, this is why we listen. This is why I listen. So when we have these moments, we can do the right thing. My son is about to embark from Florida, driving back to California.
Oh, wow.
He is terrified. He is terrified, Gus. He said, he says, Mom, can you drive with me? And I'm like, I can't right now with work and my youngest in school. It's just not within my schedule right now to drive that far, drive right now with you. And he said, I said, just take your time, leave a day early. And you know what he said? Drive by myself as a black man. Didn't you see they just shot and killed a 15-year-old boy? And then after they killed him, told him to stop running. Our children are affected. Anyone who tries to say they're not, they're only fooling themselves. But with your help, with what you're doing, it is tremendous work. It is tremendous, and thank you. From the bottom of my heart, I want to get emotional. I'm not going to get emotional. I appreciate you. Thank you, Gus.
much obliged parenting, attempted parenting in the system of white supremacy is really hard, and that is a really sloppy understatement. But I will say, super seriousness, those situations at the school, if you're not going to get that code, or, you know, if you didn't learn counter-racist codification, you didn't run into Mr. Fuller's work until your child was 10, you know, too late. Oh, well, you do the best you can with where you get the information. But if you don't have that, you at least got to be codified if your child is going to be there, because that sort of thing can, exactly what she just said, it can and does escalate on a regular basis. That sort of thing can end up where the whole family ends up being, you know, tased and shackled, and they can bar you from the school. Like, it can get really ugly when they have those type of situations there. They can call in for backup. Like, you have to be codified. Like she said, it could have been substantially worse. And I think if you have children that are old enough where you don't have to tell them it, depending on your child, you could tell them exactly what I just said, because that's true, and say, hey, I could have, you know, got loud and rowdy. I think this could have had, I mean, you could probably show them, because there's probably a lot of examples online where they got video of some black parent being hauled off and shackled. I think I played some of those clips on the compensatory call-in. So it is incumbent upon you, as an attempted parent, if you're going to be at that school, and I would say for any reason, you're going up there for a PTA meeting, you're going up there to meet with a child for disciplinary reasons regarding your child, you're going for a performance, a recital, anything, codified, anything could happen. Resource officer could be there. I could be accused of stealing, you know, a fruit snack. Anything could happen. Or my child. Be prepared, codified, and talk to your child, because in this sort of situation, she had to talk to her child as well. You need to be able to communicate with your child to kind of get them, if you need them to calm down, so that they can be codified as well. That talking about racism, critical. And again, remind me, I don't have children. I'm not talking down to anybody. I'm just saying it is a monumental task, and a part of your monumental task has got to include talking to your children about racism. If she had not been doing that, I think this situation could have been a lot worse. And just make sure I get it. I do not have children. Another reason why. Are there other folks who, I guess we have many parents. You should make sure if you have a suggestion to share, this would be a good one to not spectate, if there are any parents who have a thought, or for the report write-up. That would be mine. It's not a complaint, it's a report. Same thing for workplace racism. It's not a complaint, it is a report of a major violation.
Only reason I said complaint is what's titled on the paperwork, but you're right.
And you can even cross that out. That's Mr. Fuller's recommendation. You can just boop, cross that right out and put report. And even explain the seriousness, because this is certainly not a grievance. This is a parent and a child who were violated. Let's see.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing, ma'am. So again, sorry the circumstances. Folks, we missed totally. Certainly, if we have any parents, if you have any recommendations for mom filing her report and everything she's dealing with, if you have any thoughts to share, that would be good. Folks, we missed totally. People, we missed totally.
Be heard. Hello. May I be heard? Please go ahead, man.
Oh, okay. Got both.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Good evening, everybody. And hi, Gus. I didn't catch everything that she said, unfortunately. I heard some of the headlines, and then I had to get off. Then I heard something about writing a report and feeling guilty about not taking a white woman's help, and you don't have to feel guilty about that at all. And then I might even put that in the report, like, you know, whatever you observed because you rejected her help, because it's something that needs to be corrected. Like, they shouldn't be doing that, whatever it was that happened. And I'm sorry I can't give more input because I didn't hear it all. The book study Thursday and something that a student told me Friday driving home made me think, like, what do you call what this is, like, other than white supremacy or white power, you know, like the way that white people act as a collective. And I came up with criminally sane, because I kind of felt like a lot of times I refer to it with a friend of mine as, you know, Yorugu. We'll go, oh, that's that Yorugu, you know, but everybody doesn't know that. But I think it's criminally sane, and that's the best way I can put it for now, because this is what they do. This is just their standard operating procedure, and it is incorrect, if not, you know, all the way totally unlawful, illegal, immoral, and unethical. The event Friday that happened, I was substituting for a special education teacher that pulls out students, and a majority of the students are either non-white or they're white, but not white in a traditional sense. They're like European, children of European immigrants. But there was a black young man that I've seen before a couple times. I didn't know his name, but I've seen him. And he made it a point to tell me when we were at our pull-out reading session, he said, you know, there's a substitute here that calls me. Now, the boy's name is Octavius, okay? But he said, there's a substitute here that calls me Octavia all the time, and it makes me so mad. This little boy is in third grade. And I thought about the Delectable Negro, you know, and then this evening I thought about the book that somebody talked about, Rethinking Rufus. And I said, really? I said, and you've corrected them? And he said, yes, I keep telling him my name is Octavius, and he keeps calling me Octavia. And I didn't ask if it was a white male, because we weren't alone. There were some non-white, non-black students at the table. And, you know, in my experience as a substitute teacher, oh, they'll run and tell as soon as as soon as the right words are spoken, because, you know, they understand the higher power. I hope that's not a metaphor. But I said, listen, if I were you, every time that person says that, I would give them the coldest blank stare possible, and I would not answer. And if they ask, why aren't you answering me, I would ask back, why are you calling me Octavia? And so that's that report. I also want to share that if you've had a loan with Sally Mae, who, you know, use the power of legalism to change their name to Navient, there is an income-driven repayment plan available. It's called the IDR, income-driven repayment plan, so that way you don't go into default with your student loans that are federally backed, if, 'cause that's how Navient or Sally Mae operated. They were federally backed loans that I got. In addition to my so-called post 9/11 GI Bill, which didn't pay for everything. It is not completely compensatory in the sense that the report is correct. I can't pursue certain things financially that are credit-based, but right now I have a very low monthly payment, about less than $50 a month, because I fill out that report every, I want to say, maybe 3 years. And, you know, it allows me a few more, you know, items while I try to survive on the plantation. And I am trying to come up with 10 questions for white people for a so-called parent summit with these, oh, God, with these white people, and it's supposed to be black people, and they're trying to talk about racism in the high school that my son goes to, and I'm listening to the compensatory code for some questions. I'm also referring back to the code book, but if people every now and then have a question that they can think and throw at, you know, my direction, that would be great. I'm sorry about your incident, ma'am. I've been in your shoes. I had a principal lie on my son when in the second grade that he pointed his middle finger out the window, and I actually recorded staff with them knowing and asked them, you know, I said, hey, the principal said you saw my son pointing his middle finger. Is that what you saw? And they recorded it. And these were two white people. I was surprised they recorded it and said, no, I didn't see that. And I played it for her, and I said, listen, you're trying to make my son out to be a miscreant, and it's not going to happen. So just come out and say you don't like black kids and forgive the rest of his tuition I'm paying so I can, you know, I can go and find a school to accommodate him, or don't bother him the rest of the year. And he won't be back next year. So I know your pain all too well. And Gus, I understand why you don't have children. And that's all I want to say for tonight. Thank you. Everyone have a good night.
Much obliged, Irie, mail caller who yielded. Much obliged for your patience, sir. Proceed.
Yes, greeting Gus. Greetings the callers and listeners. Thank you again, Gus, for the platform. I sympathize with the prior caller. I understand a lot of her frustration, and I am also an attempted parent. It's a very hard scenario to deal with. I'm in the New York City public school system, which is the biggest one in America and probably the most corrupt and racist one, or one of the most corrupt and racist ones in the country as well. I go into a little bit about the ACS and about having a child removed from your home. I initially had, I've had my son since he's born, and he lives with me permanently. But in the process of that time frame, I was going back and forth to court for custody, and this caused obviously some disturbance with my son. The disturbance played out mainly in school, unfortunately. This led to school practitioners, predominantly white women, basically calling out ACS on me and stating that I'm physically abusing my son. Obviously, in this case, the stereotype of the black male beating his child, causing enormous amounts of mental and physical distress, play a role in their attitude and their perception of me. And this was very difficult to deal with. And one of the things I could make as a suggestion is to get a child advocate, somebody that's outside of the system, that knows the system, that's willing to assist and help give you some guidance. I'm not sure if something's beeping in the background.
I think it might have been someone's line, maybe out of cone or something, but I don't hear it now, so maybe it's good.
Yeah, but yes, my suggestion for that prior parent is to try to get a child advocate. Again, somebody from outside the system understands the dynamics of it. I was fortunate to find one, and we had very detailed conversations about the situation prior to inform her, and she informed me and gave me a lot of information as well, including, you know, explaining the school-to-prison pipeline in regards to special education for black males. Very informative and a wealth of information from this non-white female. And I still keep in contact with her. So that's one of my suggestions. The other one is to make sure your children jot down, keep details of things that are going on and that may be odd within the school. It does help later on down the line, because you may see yourself in a position where you're not reactionary. You're more proactive because you know the situation and you've been seeing the dynamics of what's been going on. That being said, I'm sorry for your experience, and I hope things get better for you in regards to that. I also wanted to address the attempted parent in the beginning of the show that you had playing, and I got to tell you, the conversations that you have to have with your child are never ending. And it may appear, if you've done a good job, that your child may feel a little distraught and a little bit upset about the scenario. But when they're codified enough to talk to you and tell you, which my son is 13 and he can now come to me and tell me, oh yes, this teacher, she's racist. And I ask him why. And then he'll give me the assignment that he had. And within the assignment, and it was a amazing statements from some professor that the teacher took, stating that during Reconstruction, Black women were trying to get their freedom, separating themselves from Black men and the racist society. And these are the types of things he's reading, and he's able to come back at his age of 13 and reiterate them to me. I mean, obviously, he's still learning, but he's way ahead of me when I was his age, and I'm very happy about that. But the conversations, like I said, have to be continuous, because in these schools, they read books like To Kill a Mockingbird, Black Boy, Richard Wright, and they don't decipher the books properly. So you have to read the books, and you have to come back and have conversations with them. Constantine. Yes, cowbell. As in regards to the New Jersey incident, I'm here in New York, and we initially heard that this was a drug deal that went bad. That was the big consensus across the board. This drug dealer went bad. Drug dealer went bad. 2 days later, or maybe it might have been a day later, we heard it was Black Hebrew Israelites. And Black Hebrew Israelites have been known to be boisterous and speak out loud in the streets downtown Brooklyn here, but violence, far and few in between. I could say, as passing by, going by, they'll talk and they'll get into conversations and have dialogue with people, but they are not going to lay hands on people, and at least from what I've seen, speaking from perspective. So when we heard the first initial statement come out here in the city that it was a drug deal gone bad, it made sense. But then it went to the Black Hebrew Israelites. It drew a lot of caution. And a lot of places, I'm in a predominantly non-white neighborhood, a lot of places have been under surveillance since that incident. And I mean, they literally close off stores and have a police car in front of the store that's non-white owned. So it's they've drawn a lot of attention. If that's the case, if they even did anything, we don't know the full circumstances of the story yet at all. Also, in regards to the Jew situation, as far as them becoming, I guess you could say, their own nationality, I found it odd, and I listened to Nellie Fuller. I'm so happy I listened to him the other day in regards to this, and he said, the only questions he had is, what is a Jew? What does a Jew do? And how does a Jew affect me?
30 seconds.
Yeah, and that's pretty much it. The other thing is, last but not least, health, detoxifying the liver, and just bought an air fryer and a juicer 2 months ago, so I'm on my way. All right, thank you, and peace to everybody. Enjoy the year.
Love that air fryer. I made egg rolls, veggie egg rolls in my air fryer today. Man, oh man, you can do all kinds of wonderful things with there. Love to swap air fryer recipes. Thomas Foster, and he got the juicer too, doing it tough. Thomas Foster's article before the book, Rethinking Rufus, the article, The Sexual Abuse of Black Men Under American Slavery, Journal of History of Sexuality, Volume 20. Number 3, 2011, page 450. I have shared the PDF of this report many times over the years, waiting for Rethinking Rufus, also by Thomas A. Foster. Folks, we missed totally. If you have a hand up.
Can I be heard?
M. Hondisi, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings. And greetings to everyone. It's cold. It is December. But again, with the chemtrails, they were spraying chemtrails. Really, really heavily the last 3 days, I think, maybe 2 days, 3 days, to block out the sky or the sun completely. And that's what makes it cold, or else it'd be, you know, a lot warmer than it is currently. And I've noticed that So if there's going to be a holiday, they're going to spray the chemtrails right before that so that they can block out the sun and white people can move about, out of the rays of the sun. They can move, without being affected so much. So during holidays or during special events going on in the city, very special events, that's when they do it. And then I was going to say, I heard Mr. Fuller speak a week ago about black people preserving, or black people telling white people that we'll preserve white people's genetics, or we'll preserve them as albinos if they stop white supremacy. And Dr. Frances Welsing had mentioned that. I'm pretty sure I heard her say that, if I have that correctly. And I had mentioned, asked a question about that before, is that what we're going to do? And if that is what we're going to do, and my question to Mr. Fuller is, again, what are the time frames for these things to happen? And I did send an email, but maybe I could have worded things better. But anyway, my question is, what is the time frame for us to make the decision? Are white people killing us because they're going, because they're eventually not going to be albinos anymore? Or are they killing us for another reason? And Mr. Fuller was saying, well, if they're killing us for another reason other than killing us because, eventually they won't be albinos, or eventually there won't be white people, then we have to figure that out and then, proceed accordingly. But again, what are the time frames for these things to happen? What time frames are we talking about? And I wanted to say about a lot of white people the organization of white people, they're very organized. They use things like KKK, which is 11, 11, 11. And, Masonic numbers equals 33, 11 being a particular number, 33 being a particular number. The swastika, we were speaking about this on a program that Thomas was speaking on. But the swastika is, I think it represents the circle and something about, infinity or, something like that. But the point is, white people use a lot of terms and a lot of symbols that have nothing to do with them. But I think we should, again, with Mr. Fuller, the end of what I'm trying to say is, my question is, what are the time frames for these things to happen? Thank you.
May I be heard?
Greetings, or much obliged, Imhan DC. Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. It was stated on the book club, Paul Robeson, that black people do white people's bidding. It was regarding conflict between Jackie Robinson, I think it was, and Mr. Robeson. Black people don't do white people's bidding. Black people are subject to white people, and they're victims of racism. You made a statement, actually, also on that book club about how, or you pointed out, you pointed out how white people, they surveil us, and they, they designate people. They hire people just to watch us and just to surveil us, and that's what they did to Mr. Robeson because, he was a counter-racist. And I like that you really pointed that out. It really made me think, that I hadn't really realized the scope of white supremacy, that, just the scope of the problem, that it's not just, the violence that we would encounter in trying to solve the problem, but just the sophistication of white supremacy, to the point where they have think tanks and they have, COINTELPRO and operations like that. It was also stated that on the when Azure Savage came on the program, Later on that night, it was stated that her father wasn't present. She said her father was present. And also it was stated on a compensatory call-in program that black people were murdered by Dylan Storm Roof because they were so happy for a white male to come in the church that they let their guard down. Those black people were not murdered because they did not die because they were happy for a white male to come into the church. They were murdered because Dylan Storm Roof murdered them. He alone is responsible for what he did. Black people are not responsible for what white people do, especially for what white people do to us. And I just want to quickly say that what I think it means, because I think a lot about this, I'm glad you say it all the time, what I think it means to be white is to pillage. And I hope everyone has as best weekend as they can have, and I'll meet my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Azure Savage does identify as he. Just, you know, hopefully he will come back and, yeah, just make sure, for the record, Azure, he, him, those would be the pronouns. Anybody that we missed before we have like 2 minutes left in the program? Anybody we missed? Everybody grand?
Can I ask a quick question?
Let's hear a quick question.
Are we not allowed to, you know, on your program, because this is your program, so if that's, you know, the rule on your program, I will honor that and try my best, I guess, to go around it. I don't want to call Azure a man because Azure is not a man. And for me, that's just confusion, and you're just confusing me, and I really don't want to allow you to confuse me. So if that's what you refer to as or whatever, I mean, I'm not going to call you a different name or something like that, but in terms of gender, I'm not going to say, you know, you're a man when you're not a man. But again, if that is your rule that I must call her a man, then I will try my best to get around that. But that is just confusing for me, and I don't want to participate in something that is confusing me. So, yeah, that was my question.
Counter-racism is supposed to be about eliminating confusion. That is key. So I certainly respect anyone who keeps that, who is mindful of that, doing things to make sure that they are not confused. And, oh, I have the book right here. Now, this is why I sometimes prefer having the electronic copy. I have the hard copy of Azure's book. So I can't do the cool thing where I can see how many times the word confused is in this book. But I'm pretty sure it's in here a number of times, the word confused. And if you can even go back and listen to the broadcast when he visited us. I guess in response to the question, I do advocate. I think Mr. Fuller, a lot of folks in counter-racism do try to advocate calling people what they want to be called. I know for sometimes that can be conflict, like a person says they want to be identified as he, and like, you know, if you present, you look like a female, it just seems like it's confusion. I don't want to participate in that. Sometimes it can cause conflict. So I don't know. Azure has listened since being a guest on the program. So I suspect he might be willing to come back and chat. Perhaps you could ask that question. Or present, you know, that you are resistant to identifying Azure as he and why, and get a response. Maybe we could do that. That would be interesting. I think if Azure is willing to come back on the program, is that something you think about to see if it would be constructive, to see if you could maybe pose that, think of a way you could phrase it and pose it in a question to see, get a response from Azure?
Absolutely, and I think she said that she understands people saying she because that's what she looks like. And I think, and I could be wrong, I think she said she don't really mind, but the particular, you know, pronouns that she uses is he. So I don't think that she minds if other people call her she, but I don't know. But yes, most definitely.
All right. Well, I will see if we can get Azur back on the program, because I did miss the racist jokes. That was, you know, a big one that I missed. And there would be other things to chat on as well. But, yeah, that would be interesting. And I do remember Azur saying that other I referred to her as her, she, until we got on the program. Or actually, it was before that. It was when they finally posted the article. And at KUOW, Seattle Public Radio, they were saying he, him. And I said, oh, we'll have to ask to make sure. And then on the program, he. So I've been saying he, him since then. I think I may have made an error since then, but I do try to say he, him just because, you know, call people what they want. But yeah, I think that would be great. I think that would be constructive, and we should be trying to minimize confusion. The sexual confusion is massive, any component of white supremacy racism. So we'll see if we can make that happen. With that, we did our 3 hours plus a couple extra. We'll be here on talk about confusion. My gosh, I can telegraph. So the first question on Monday is not going to be a definition of racism, blah, 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 blah. Do you think such a system exists? Is that accurate? It's going to have to be the other way around. What is your definition of racism? And wait, that is... You got to be here at the word. I guess most people listen to the archives, so make sure you listen to the very beginning. What, Clifford Thompson, what is your definition of racism? That is question one for Monday. Clifford Thompson, cowbell, author of the book, What It Is, supposed to be about him interviewing white men who voted for Trump in 2016 to get a better understanding of white supremacy racism, what it means to be white. I have read a third of this book. I have not come across one interview yet. I've heard a lot about white women, his white wife, biracial children, black people complaining about white people, not one interview of a white man. And I am a third of the way into the book. Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I hope the broadcast was worthy of your time and energy. Attempted parents, man, that is the hardest job, one of the hardest jobs, I'll say, in the known universe. Wow. You have my utmost respect. Make sure you're talking to your offspring about white supremacy, racism. It is, you know, crucial. Crucial, life-saving, really. That's the way that you should think about it, because unfortunately, if you have a situation like what our black mom shared with us this evening, imagine having that, and that's the first time that you have to talk to them in a very blunt manner about white supremacy racism. Things could be drastically worse. Talk to your children about racism, white supremacy, so that they are not confused about why these types of things can and do happen regularly to black people, victims of racism. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. That time of year, checkpoints, holiday parties, lots of opportunities for unnecessary disasters and problems. Let's keep our brain computer working correctly going into 2020. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver, doing all we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being buckled up, we are not on the cell phone. If you are driving, we are doing everything we can to not see the Amber Geigers and Daniel Holtzclaws of the known universe. With that, man. Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern. I'm excited. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed. I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.